Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It ain't night, it's the middle of the day. It is the beginning of a weird, weird broadcast day for me because I don't work in daytime, but this is still the horn. This is America's liberal voice, and this is, in fact, very special programming coming to you live from Progressive Media Row, the campaign for America's future and America's future now. Hey, this thing's on, huh? Pretty exciting. Got a great lineup of guests coming this afternoon, tomorrow afternoon, and the following afternoon. I have a feeling that we will touch on every single issue that exists within the world of liberal thought. That's what you can expect. And no, we're not high in the hills of West by God, beautiful West by God. What's left of beautiful West by God, almost level West Virginia. We are not, we are not, we are not. In fact, where we are is in a hallway of the storied Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C. Everybody who does liberal broadcasting is here. There's an interview just across the way from me going on with Monica Williams. Tom Hartman is catty-cornered to my right by about 20-25 feet. Warren Valentine's here. I've seen John Elliott go by a couple of times here and there. This is going to be an exciting day, a very exciting day. I've just been fired by someone who is unhappy with the Service Employees International Union. Maybe we'll try to find out a little bit about that later on in the afternoon. But this is the beginning of the broadcast day. It will continue from now through 3 p.m. for my show. Hopefully, I know Ben Birch is already on the job. We will repeat my program from 6 to 9 this evening. In the air right now, on his way, winging his way toward Washington, D.C., is none other than Guy James. He will be with us presently. He will probably arrive here about 2 p.m. and be as happy a human being as I can imagine there being. Just to see everything working and knowing that it's all kind of a no-sweat situation. He'll do his regular show from 3 to 5 p.m. And after that, Mark Levine of the Radio Inside Scoop will come your way. So we've got a very busy broadcast day for you, and we're going to get right to it. And our first guest is with us now, Scott Paul of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, if you'd like to help yourself to a set of headphones there. You're more than welcome. Let's make sure everything works. I tested it out, but you never take anything for granted. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Bob, nice to meet you.
It's a real pleasure to meet you. It's wonderful to be here and see all of these various and sundry progressive and liberal energies coming together to create something, a whole that I hope is far greater than the sum of its parts.
I agree. I walked in. It's sort of like the progressive Star Wars cantina. Lots of interesting stories and worlds colliding, but all with one purpose.
And you are a part of that purpose, Scott. First off, let's just do a little bit of background work. Tell us all, please, a little bit about the Alliance for American Manufacturing, because there's another group out there that isn't you.
That's exactly right. We are a labor management partnership, which makes us pretty unique. It was formed by the United Steelworkers Union, which is America's largest industrial union, and some of its domestic employers who are committed to keeping jobs in the United States. We focus on issues like trade policy, the importance of a strong manufacturing base. We've done a lot of work on the auto industry lately because of the connection that it, the strong connection it has with manufacturing jobs. And trying to change people's perceptions about factories today, how they're not your grandfather's mills, that manufacturing is modern and it's essential to America's future, just as it was a proud part of our past.
And those are some of the as it goes, those are some of the best best jobs in America, are they not? I mean, it's still.
They are. They're not only do they tend to pay better, they pay about 20% better than jobs in the retail sector or other sectors of the economy, because it is skilled work and it's difficult work. But they also have a higher multiplier effect. They support more jobs in the economy. When you have a manufacturing plant, it's going to be supplied, and mm-hmm. it's also going to obviously generate some revenue from the folks' paychecks.
Somebody has to make the stuff to help them make
That's
the
That's exactly
stuff that
right.
They make.
So you have with, you know, downstream suppliers, upstream mm-hmm. suppliers, logistics. A manufacturing job supports four or five other jobs at a minimum. And actually in the auto sector it's more. It's about seven other jobs. So you don't get that kind of multiplier effect in information age jobs or in retail or service sector jobs or, you know, blogging or being on the radio, as important as that is.
Sadly true, yes.
But it, I mean, one of the challenges that we're going to see, especially from this GM bankruptcy.
And I really hope we can talk about that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about it, is that, you know, it's going to impact auto assembly jobs, but the ripple effect that's going to be felt in communities is going to go far deeper than that. And we're going to see hundreds of thousands of Americans who are affected by this announcement.
You know, that was the first thing. There was a certain sad irony to it this morning. I got up and I turned on the news, and I see plane crashes in Atlantic, GM declares bankruptcy, and I thought, sadly, those are two of the same story, because in either instance, there. And I don't mean to diminish the human tragedy of the plane crash, but if America allows its manufacturing base, especially its union organized manufacturing base, to simply go the way of the dodo, are we not effectively foreshortening our own future?
Well, we're destroying our economy. But there's no finer example of that than what we've seen happen over the last year, where wages have been stagnant, people have maintained their standard of living by borrowing more. China has been happy to lend us money if we're buying more products from China. And right. It becomes a feedback loop that is not at all positive. And it creates mountains of debt. It leaves closed factories and lost jobs in its wake. And it mortgages our economic future. And we've been far too focused on short-term profits and making a quick buck and figuring out how to do a credit default swap than making the things that are going to drive us to wealth and prosperity and broadly shared prosperity, because, as you point out, many of these manufacturing jobs are good union jobs with good benefits and fair wages that can support strong families and strong communities. We're losing a lot of that. We've lost almost one out of every four manufacturing jobs in the last decade. And unfortunately, Bob, this is accelerating. This trend is accelerating.
It's almost like it's becoming exponential, isn't it? Because there's a negative effect that flows from that positive effect you talked about, where manufacturing creates four or five downstream jobs. When the jobs go away, they take four or five with them, don't they?
That's right. And then none of those jobs are coming back. And you know, there are some people who say, oh, it'll be great to have the factory out of my community. Or we need to focus as a society on four-year college degrees and higher education, and we need to be an information age country. You cannot be a successful information age country unless you also have a manufacturing base.
I think you're absolutely correct.
It's the foundation of a strong economy, and it's not an either-or question. We have to do both. And manufacturing provides 80% of the patents that are generated in the United States every year. two-thirds of the private research and development that we depend on. They employ more scientists and engineers than any other sector of the economy. And so it's not just the blue-collar assembly job that is highly skilled that's being displaced. It's these other jobs as well. And then you look at what's the alternative. What do we move into? Two-thirds of all manufacturing workers who lose their jobs end up in jobs that pay less and have far fewer benefits. So that's less money circulating the economy.
Certainly, yeah.
That's a lower tax base. And it doesn't give you the exponential value like the manufacturing job does. And so when you have these academics or these theoreticians that say, oh, all this churning is good because people ultimately end up in a better situation because of it. It's just, in the real world, it doesn't work.
Well, I think you're correct. I heard the mayor of Lansing, Michigan this morning on the television. And
he's a good friend of ours. Yeah. Bernero.
Exactly. And I couldn't remember his name. Shame on me. It was heartbreaking to hear him because he was saying things with which I completely agree. But it seemed that in being there on CNN, he was saying it to people who don't get it. And I heard a phrase that, frankly, I'd not heard before, and maybe you can elaborate on this a little bit, or maybe you just did. He said, for years we have been told that we are moving to a post-production or post-manufacturing economy. And he said, we have finally learned that there is no such thing. Is it a post-manufacturing economy? Have you heard that phrase before? Is that some sort of Zen minimalist idea for what America's future is, that we're going to let everybody else make the stuff and we're just going to be happy little consumers? Isn't that nuts?
That's the theory. It is crazy. If we outsource our production to China, what we get ultimately you might find a lower cost at Walmart temporarily, but what you ultimately get are workers who are making less and who are spending less money in the economy. You're getting less tax revenue to support public education and a good infrastructure. You're having less opportunities for the next generation to fulfill the American dream. And I think that there is an incredible disconnect between everyday American life and the value of manufacturing. And it used to be much more apparent. It actually used to be portrayed differently, actually, in popular culture.
Sure.
And now it's really scorned, unfortunately, and that has a...
Where did that come from?
I wish I knew where exactly it came from, but there was this caricature developed of the worker and of the factory, and that this is a dirty job that you didn't want your kid to get into, and that
interestingly and though that they didn't caricature the shareholder class. They didn't caricature the silk suited boss. They caricatured the working stiff.
That's right. The people who tried to create financial instruments that did nothing but generate profits for themselves and wreaked havoc on our economy are looked at as geniuses, maybe misguided geniuses, but that they're really smart. People who take pride in their craft, who make quality products that we value and who help drive America forward and support strong communities through their tax dollars and their paychecks flowing into the grocery stores and the
right.
corner store, they tend to be scorned too often, and they're treated vastly differently. You know, the whole episode with GM is the most shameful example of this recently, because it's like, even the Obama administration, I think, is a bit misguided here. It's like, we want GM to be profitable in 5 years. That's the stated goal. But at what cost? I mean, if they're going to be outsourcing more, closing down factories, dramatically shrinking, ultimately, you know, the car market in the United States is going to rebound. People are going to start buying cars
right.
again. And instead of buying GM cars or Chrysler Fiat or Ford cars, they're going to be buying imports. And then that's
right.
money that is not... being recirculated in the American economy. You can't have a post-manufacturing economy. You're going to be a poor nation that's dependent on others. And I don't mean this in a jingoistic way.
No.
But I mean it in a there's some advantage to having a little bit of self-sufficiency and realizing that we live in a globalized world. And I have no quarrel with globalization at all. But it doesn't mean you can't value your manufacturing base.
No, it doesn't. And there's globalization and there's globalization, isn't there, Scott? I mean, it seems like the globalization model with which we have wound up is a model in which American workers are driven to the substandard wages of the developing world, where the preferable model, I think, even among the people, the liberal side of the debate who pushed the idea of globalization, was that we want to lift people up.
That's right.
And that hasn't
happened. That's right. It shouldn't be that you're pitting workers against each other. It should be that you are usefully dividing what people do best, and so that everyone's benefiting
right.
from it. That's the fundamental principle behind comparative advantage and free trade. If people actually read what Ricardo and Smith wrote instead of trying to turn it into their own warped philosophy, it should be free trade at any cost. Oh, it totally is. If you read Adam Smith and David Ricardo, they view it in a very static world, and I don't have a quarrel with what they say. But the way that it's practiced, the way that it's put into practice, the rules that have been put into place protect profits, protect global companies, and leave workers very exposed. And that wasn't a world that Ricardo and Smith had even contemplated, but that's the world that our workers are living in today, and they don't feel like the government is on their side and that the government's taking the side of the big companies. I think that we need to put into place an industrial policy. It doesn't mean that we're going to have a state-run economy, but we need policies that value having industry in the United States. We need to realize that it's going to be part of our green future.
That is where I want to go. And I want to go there fairly promptly because I know you're going to be doing other discussions. Frankly, the format that we work in here at the Horn, we call Conversation Radio, and this is something that I would delight in taking a couple of hours of your time on my regular show some evening and
going at it
in great depth. You mentioned, we want GM to turn be profitable again in 5 years, and you said at what cost? I'm right on track with you there. Doesn't a philosophy like that sort of ignore the fact that other manufacturing countries and other manufacturing bases do not operate on that philosophy? That the German shareholder model, for instance, does not demand that there be 50 cents on the quarterly profit and loss statement every time. It rather favors long-term growth and long-term investment quality and long-term health for the industry. If we continue to move with that profit above all else right now, give it to me now, the Willy Wonka approach to investing, are we not shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of how because you take something like that, you couple it with the way competing countries, industrialized countries, treat their workers vis-a-vis health care and pensions, and we keep marrying it to this piratized notion of somehow making it part of the profit model along the way. Aren't we marching uphill with one foot in a bucket?
We're shooting ourselves in the bucket at the same time. And I'm glad you mentioned Germany because, Germany is a manufacturing powerhouse. German wages higher than American manufacturing wages. German health care equally as generous as American health care. Here's the fundamental difference. They've taken health care off the bargaining table and have a national health care plan, which is very sane. And, in fact, we had a Wall Street financier at a teach-in on Capitol Hill on the auto sector about a week and a half ago who said we need a national health care system. So even some enlightened business leaders agree that we need to do this. And the German model is also very cooperative with the workforce.
Yes.
And I think that's another lesson that needs to be learned, is that people want to vilify, for example, the UAW for the demise of GM. Actually, labor costs account for less than 10% of every car. What's gone up is healthcare costs countrywide.
Right.
You know, not just for
well, that whole thing makes me crazy, Scott, because that's a creation of the right wing and the control that they exert over the media. The control they exert over supposed economic thought, and blame the worker, as you noted, whether it's caricaturing Ralph Cramden or Archie Bunker down at the docks, we made working people funny people, we made working people who could be vilified, and whether it's all those are all models that are promulgated out of places that aren't staffed by working people, if you know what I mean.
That's exactly right. And these are the same people, and I'm going to be doing my own caricaturing now, I'm afraid, that instead of having their kids figure out how to fix the chain on their bike, they're sitting behind a Nintendo or a Wii all day playing it. And, you know, there's a natural tendency among human beings to want to tinker and figure things out and to engineer, nearly everyone. And we're depriving essentially a whole generation of young people of figuring out whether that's something that may interest them or not. And you go to a high school today, you talk to the guidance counselor, they're not going to steer you into a career that's anywhere close to manufacturing, and they're not going to offer vocational education. It's all about testing, and getting you into the right four-year college.
But at what point in time do we recognize that you're not just talking about the worker issues? You're not what your organization is talking about is not just economic issues. To the extent that we talk about manufacturing in America, we're talking about national security issues as well. When FDR was dealing with the Great Depression, he was dealing with an idled workforce and shuttered factories. But the factories existed, Scott, okay? They're not here now. And,
that's right.
And I've had it put to me that if God forbid that day should come when we have to ramp up production for something serious, like, you know, defending our nation against global fascism, you know, that kind of thing, we're screwed.
Yeah, to put it mildly, I mean, these same factories that supply Ford, GM, Chrysler, you know, also make military equipment as well, and these same workers have these skills, and you're going to lose both. There will come a day when people wake up and realize it, and maybe this will be manufacturing salvation, but that we can't build the next generation of M1 Abrams tanks here, or that we can't do the next fighter plane, or that we lose the ability to build our naval fleet to project power around the world. And it doesn't make a difference where you stand on wars or anything like that, but if we want to properly equip our military to be lean and strong, we're going to lose that ability in a hurry to do it unless we value manufacturing again. Because the defense industrial base is part of the manufacturing base. We're losing that capacity at an alarming rate. The NSA, and this may not be a great example, and I don't like to use it for progressive audiences myself, but there was no reliable maker of a certain type of printed circuit boards in the United States, so the NSA had to set up its own factory to do it. You're seeing example after example of that. The equipment that we used to track Chinese submarines, the sonobuoys, we had to have electronic equipment manufactured in China to do this because we lack the ability to do that.
You know, the funny thing is, though, I remember back in the 90s when the right wing was having a purple polka-dotted blue scream and hissy, Scott, over L'Oreal and, you know, my friend Bill Clinton sold us out to the Tricoms and all of that foolishness, but they're not so bothered with this. Do they just have this partitioned brain where they can deal with it if it's to their benefit, but if not,
They pay lip service to national security, but the policies that they have espoused have done more to undermine it than anything else. And when you lose the ability to make the things that keep your country safe, you've sacrificed national security, along with the myriad of other examples that go along with the right wing on this. But I'm also afraid that there is still this connection that is too strong between Wall Street and the Democratic Party as well.
Oh.
That needs to be broken because, I mean, Wall Street economics got us into this mess.
Yes.
And we need to get out of this mess with Main Street economics. We need to focus again on revitalizing our communities from the ground up and not worry about the next great financial instrument that's going to be developed that's going to make a few people a ton of money. That's not going to be the economic salvation of this country.
You can't have an economic salvation, I don't think, Scott, that's based on something that isn't real. You've got to be able to put your hand on something. I admit it's probably a nasty little bit of bias on my part. I've run you past our time. I'm so sorry. Are we okay?
Yeah, I'm good for a few more minutes.
Okay,
Bob.
Because
happy to talk to you.
I really want to see us. I want to get a few words in about the green economy because we're headquartered in West Virginia, and that means the absolute world to us. They're blowing up our homes shake from mountaintop removal,
coal
extraction.
Right.
And we need the green economy to come forward. What is it going to take to get America serious about green manufacturing? I know the steel workers and the Blue Green Alliance and things like that, they're very serious about it, but what's it going to take to light them up?
I think it's going to take a realization that we can't repeat the mistakes of the past that we've made with the traditional manufacturing sector, which is that we're very good at developing technologies, we're very good at consuming technologies, we're not very good at manufacturing the stuff here. And it takes industrial policy, it takes the right trade policies, it takes healthcare, so it takes those structural changes to make it possible. But we also need to realize that our manufacturing base is part of the green economy. There are 250 tons of steel in every wind turbine that's made. That should be American steel because American steel is greener than Chinese steel.
By far.
We have, just sitting here in the exhibit hall, a Ford Escape hybrid manufactured in Kansas City, Missouri, that has 450 pounds of steel made by ArcelorMittal, has 27 parts made that include steel from United States Steel in it. This is all part of the green economy, and you have to realize that there's a connection here. You need the supply chains. You need the domestic manufacturing. Domestic manufacturing is part of green manufacturing, clean manufacturing. We can do climate change legislation. We should do it. But we need to recognize that our manufacturers can make the changes to go to a smaller carbon footprint, and they have to do it. But they're not going to be able to do it unless China does it too, or unless we penalize China.
We've absolutely got to. You know, Copenhagen is coming up quick, and I've heard John Kerry speaking about it some. We've got to get them on board. I know they're resistant to it, but we absolutely must because. You know, to say that there's a difference between a developing or an emerging nation or an emerging economy and a developed one when the emerging one is burning a million times as much coal and doing it very ungreenly, downright dirtily. We're back to that level playing field, aren't
That's
we?
That's right. That's exactly right. And this is not an issue of protectionism. I mean, even
Tom Friedman,
The World is Flat, New York Times columnist, big globalization supporter, you couldn't find a stronger supporter of a carbon tariff in America. This is a guy who is no friend of domestic manufacturing. He's like, look, for this to work effectively, we need a global solution. We need to have a carbon tariff put on to offset the carbon costs from China, from India, if they're going to bring dirtier goods in this country. We have to do it to succeed.
Yeah, exactly. Scott Paul, like I said, I really hope we will have a longer conversation. I know you're going to be very busy today, and I wish you the best in getting your message out. Thank you very kindly.
Well, thank you, Bob, for the opportunity and for the work that you're doing. I'll look forward to spending some more time with you.
Great. I've got your card, and we'll be in touch. All right. Thank you.
Thanks again.
Scott Paul, Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, a partnership between labor and management that takes a sane approach to manufacturing issues and the redevelopment of the American manufacturing base. Let me see if our next guest is ready. We are joined momentarily by John Kaiser. John is, to say the very least, a well-read man and a well-written man. He has a new book out. He has written a number of books. The book itself. Very good. The book out is Commander of the Faithful, The Life and Times of Emir Abdelkader.
That's good.
I wish I had read it. I will be honest, I have not. I tender you my sincere apologies on that end, but I have read the information that is available about it.
The nature of, and
we've got headphones for you here if you'd like. You'll need your microphone fairly close to you there. Most people, historically speaking, in terms of Muslim history, heroes, warriors, and the like, if they know anyone, they know Saladin. And after that, the intellectual drop-off is significant.
And maybe the Prophet Muhammad.
Right, exactly.
Sex pervert.
The right way. Oh, God. But you have picked an individual as a topic for your book who is not someone who is mainstream to most people. Tell us a little bit about Abdelkader, please.
Well, he was a famous warrior saint of the 19th century who established his reputation fighting the French after they invaded Algeria in 1830. Which was then part of the Ottoman Empire. And he became widely admired by his enemies as well as by observers, including people in the United States, for his extraordinary combination of warrior skills, even though he was raised as a marabout and as a religious scholar, but he was kind of drafted into leading the jihad against the French. But not only was he a very wily and resourceful and resilient warrior, he was a great religious scholar, sincere in his piety, a man of his word, compassionate towards prisoners. He treated French prisoners extraordinarily well. It was his greatest secret weapon, actually. The French generals had to keep that under their hat because a lot of their soldiers wouldn't have fought otherwise. And he was, a man of self-restraint, compassion, learning, both a progressive in his way of thinking about improving society, but also very puritanical and orthodox in his religious faith. So he was an interesting complex of qualities that would confuse us today.
Well, given all of that, it sounds to me like there. I mean, obviously, the France of 1830 of first third of the 19th century was as much a world power as anything we might say that we are today. So was that the jumping off point for your scholastic inquiry, or what set you down the path for this man?
Well, two things. I got interested in the Arab world as a result of spending a year in France in 1994 and 1995, and I knew very little about Islam, just generalities. But for the first time in my life, I actually met real Muslims and Arabs, most of whom are from North Africa, and, met them, had dinner with them, engaged in real conversation. So I was obviously quite surprised when I learned that a lot of Muslims actually carry the name Jesus. Isa is a very common Muslim name, and
sure.
their respect for Jesus is probably matches that of most Christians, or maybe even better, with one exception. They don't believe he's the Son of God, but they do believe he's a prophet without sin. They honor him. In fact, some Muslims even consider him a higher prophet than the Muhammad because he was a sinless prophet. They honor the Virgin Mary. They consider him the Messiah. So he is a figure in their hagiography of prophets, which is highly respected. And So I began to think, well, why are we having, well, this is news to me that we demonize Muslims when in fact they love Jesus. So I got interested in them, partly in that part of the world, partly just to educate myself more, and then I became very interested in France's love-hate relationship with Algeria,
right,
which bore sort of parallels with our relationship with the West and the subjection of the Indians. And then I saw France's bumbling invasion of Algiers in 1830. They were unprepared, ignorant, arrogant, and messing up tremendously, and made me feel that there was a kind of a parallel here that was kind of didn't need to be made explicit. It was so obvious.
Is now this man, as you describe him, sounds like a very, very enlightened man for his time, although you've mentioned very, very puritanical or what we might call fundamentalist. Do you see parallels between him and, say, you know, the Osama bin Laden?
Well, I don't know about it. No, I don't, because Osama bin Laden, I don't think, has anything close to the scholarly knowledge and knowledge of the book that the emir had. But I think more importantly, I think some of the tools that that Osama used is would have been considered by Abdul Qadir totally un-Islamic and not permissible. Killing innocents was not something he approved of, and he punished severely his own troops when they captured any enemy soldiers and decapitated them on the battlefield after they'd surrendered. I think there's a parallel, perhaps only in the sense that those who apparently have spent time with Osama have been impressed by his sort of politeness, his character. He's clearly committed to his mission, but I would say his interpretation of the way you live your Islam and way jihad were things are things that Emir Abdul Qadir would have rejected.
When we talk about the kind of man that Qadir was, do you see is there someone who matches or comes close to in terms of similarities his characteristics in the Muslim world today?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are many. I'd be very confident saying there are many, many Abdul Qadirs. I mean, there are many people who do. You know, one of the things that he did that made him really a world figure. And won the accolades of President Lincoln and Queen Victoria and the Pope was his saving the lives of thousands of Christians in the U.S. diplomatic, Russian, French diplomatic communities in Damascus during an attempted pogrom by the Turks, who were upset with the Christians for a variety of reasons, including not paying their taxes. And he, even though he'd been invaded by Christians, French Christians, you know, 20 years earlier, he could make distinctions, and the people that he, saved were obviously innocents. He won great acclaim for that. Well, during that same 4 or 5 days of horror, many other Muslims also saved Christians' lives on a smaller scale. They weren't as famous, didn't get as much attention. In the book that I wrote just preceding this book about the monks of Tiberine, the protagonist, the Christian prior of the Trappist monastery, his calling was marked by the fact that his own life had been saved by a Muslim that he had befriended when he was a soldier in Algeria in 1959. Who had intervened in a situation where the Frenchman could have been killed, and he put his life at risk and saved the Christian's life, and his name was Christian de Cherge. The next day his throat was slit for sympathizing with the enemy, and I know from my experience in Pakistan recently, there are all kinds of small acts of kindness and compassion and consideration shown to Christians in many ways that don't get reported because they're not glamorous, they're not sensational, they're not violent, and
they
don't fit with the media model. I'll just give you one very small, insignificant sounding example, but I think a friend of mine is a Catholic, went to Karachi, wanted to go to a mass in a church in Karachi, which he did, and she was surprised to see as many Christians in the pews as there were, but then she found out that there was a mosque right next door, and one of the Muslim prayer periods is sort of coincided with with the mass. And she went and visited the mosque and asked about that and why, you know, and learned that the imam made sure that they didn't have any calls to prayer during the mass to not interfere with the Christian service and be a distraction. They seemed to be competing. So that's kind of little small examples of consideration for the other faith. Are things that, you know, just go below the radar, but there's lots of that that goes on in the Muslim world, but it's not noticed.
Is the fostering of someone like Amir Khadr, is that something that the U.S. can do, or is that something that has to rise organically in the Muslim world?
Well, it's a little bit of both. In fact, I went to Pakistan in January through an organization called the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, which has an active program of working with Pakistani madrasas to help them reform their curriculum to include more worldly subjects, more content that is, you know, relates to getting jobs in the real world and not simply studying the Quran, which is important as well. But besides this moral foundation, they want to expand the curriculum for other subjects. I was invited to present the book to madrasa leaders in three different cities, in Lahore, Islamabad, in Karachi, and in every place. And this was, I was invited by a local Muslim whose name was Abdul Qadar as well, Abdul Qadar. Oh, really? Khamush. And the reception to Abdul Qadar's story was very favorable, and they want the book now translated into Urdu and to use his life story as a tool to discuss what is real jihad, what is how does a Muslim warrior actually conduct himself in war, and what does it mean to be a good Muslim in war and peace and in prison, since those are all conditions that the emir experienced.
And that, of course, is a partial title or part of the title of the book, A True Story of Jihad.
A
Story of True Jihad, my bad. Can you give a working definition of true versus false jihad?
I think so. I mean, what it is what, you know, monks and Christians and Jews and all religious people who are really deeply pious and striving to do God's will is, it's a process of continual spiritual hygiene of, you know, getting those dust balls out from under the bed every day. It's what the Catholics call, you know, dealing with the seven deadly sins, pride, envy, greed, anger, lust, and all those fun things, which, you know, to make yourself a proper vessel to understand and serve God. And in his case, you know, it's not like it's just a matter of warfare. It's a matter of fighting righteous, of living a righteous life and trying to struggle. Holy struggle, I think, is the usual translation of jihad. Holy struggle to live a godly and righteous life, whether you're in war or in prison or living a...
Right, very much an internalized...
It's inner purification, an inner struggle. And there is the little jihad, which Muhammad refers to in one of his hadiths, in which he'd come back from a battle and said, you know, we've just had the little jihad, now we have to focus on the big jihad, which is heal thyself is what it's all about. You can't bring peace and stability to the world if your own internal world is awash in anger, envy, pride, greed, and all that other things.
Chaos, and, sure.
Yeah. So... the notion of jihad as he lived it is very familiar to Muslims and perfectly understandable. It's just that because it's the term has been mediatized to focus solely on the combative and the combative in a way that is not Quranic, the word has kind of become a dirty word. But it's interesting. To fight in a Quranically correct way, sort of the Muslim Geneva Convention. And Abdul Qadr adhered to these. There are six or seven don'ts, or prohibitions. One is you don't drop napalm on forests. You don't destroy nature. You don't shoot anyone in the face because that's the image of God. You don't mutilate dead bodies. You don't harm prisoners. And he was very strict on that. It was very unpopular. Mm-hmm. And you certainly don't kill innocents. So he lived by that code, and he required his lieutenants and his followers to live by that code as well. And it won him great acclaim and great respect. And when he was in prison in France, after he'd surrendered voluntarily, when he realized that continued resistance to France was vain and just useless and would just cause a useless loss of life, he did a deal with the French in which they said, okay, you know, this is wonderful. You know, after 20 years we've been chasing you around. And they allowed him to, they promised to send him into exile in return for, you know, laying down his arms and not coming back and making trouble. And the generals believed him. Anyway, the government changed a few weeks after this deal was made. There was a new government, and the deal was annulled. And he spent 5 years cooling his heels in different chateaus, actually, in France. But throughout that period, among his admirers and supporters who were trying to get him freed were soldiers and prisoners, people who had been his prisoner and were so admiring of the way he had handled them and treated them that they became his lobbyists, in effect. And then he was a guy who could make elementary distinctions, you know, when to kill Christians and when to save their lives. And when they were attacking his country, he was very effective at killing them. When they were sacrificial lambs to the Turks in a different context, he went and saved their lives.
And that seems to go far beyond the simple rubric of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That there were moral distinctions made there.
Absolutely, absolutely. In the case of what he was doing in Damascus in 1860, I mean, he was just there's a very clear, straightforward verse in the Quran that says it's in the Torah too, in the Jewish tradition. He who kills one innocent person who has done no harm or not created disorder in the world is doing as if they were killing all humanity. In other words, each person is made in the image of God, and when you kill one person, you're attacking the image of God. You are in essence attacking all of humanity, and that's a very basic surah that almost all Muslims know.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. You mentioned early in our discussion the similarities or the parallels between the way France treated its Muslim colonies versus the way the United States treated its native population. And in the course of your discussion of what became of Amir Khadr after his surrender, I couldn't help but recall both Osceola and Geronimo as well.
And you could think of Tecumseh and I you have to refresh my memory on Osceola and Geronimo, what we did to them. I guess, took care of the Seminoles, right?
They really never got taken care of because they're the only Indian people in North America never to sign a treaty with the American government. They run bingo parlors now in South Florida. We pushed them into the Everglades, but Osceola waged a profound war, and they hunted him like a dog.
That's right. Yeah.
Geronimo surrendered manfully and decently and was imprisoned at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, until George W. Bush's grandfather dug up his skull and took it back to Yale.
I'll be darned. Well, you know, the difference is, while I think Abdel Kader was probably an equal or superior to the Osceolas in terms of tenacity and wiliness and the manner of fighting, which is similar. It was hit and run. You don't go into pitch battles with people who have superior firepower.
What we call now asymmetric warfare.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
I mean, but what the difference is that actually, Abdel Kader, even though the French government sort of annulled the agreement of their generals under the monarchy, they treated him and his entourage with considerable respect. They were put in prisons, but the prisons were royal chateaus. If you could imagine Osceola being put in Mount Vernon.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
he was actually in historic landmarks. And, of course, the people in Poe weren't terribly happy about having this Arab savage in the birthplace of Henry IV. But the war ministry insisted on it because of this. They needed it was safe, and they needed all that space. But what the French did, which is admirable, is is they gave him very good handlers, people who were there to essentially inform to the Ministry of War, tell him what was going on, who he was seeing, what his state of mind was. But they all spoke Arabic. They'd all been in Algeria. They knew him personally in some cases. And they all became, they were cultivated men. And they all became his champions and lobbied on his behalf to get the French to honor the agreement of the prior government. You know, and they certainly never abused him physically and mentally. Of course, he was abused because he was where he wasn't supposed to be. He was in a clammy,
right,
clammy chateaus, and his people were dying of pneumonia and dysentery. And
it's not your
depression.
It's not your world anyway.
Not your world, exactly. And the French had made a deal, and he insisted on holding them to their word, even if it meant dying in prison. And so he was willing to humiliate the French. Because there were big debates in the French in Parliament as to whether they should honor the agreement or not. And there were two camps, those who said he doesn't deserve to be honored, he's just a brigand and a thief and a savage and doesn't deserve to be treated honorably. And then the others, who tended to be more often than not people who came from aristocratic backgrounds, saying, no, you know, he was an honorable opponent, and France's good word means something, and we should honor this agreement. And that debate went back and forth for 5 years.
Do you have a preferred means for potential purchasers of your book to obtain same?
I don't have a preferred means, but the possibilities range from going to your local bookstore and ordering the book. It's probably not in the bookstore since it came out in November of last year, but you can get it over Amazon, Amazon.com. Go to John Kaiser and see the other books that are available that I've written, two of which have to do with Algeria. My publisher, Monkfish Publishing in Rhinebeck, New York, can send you boxes of books if you want bulk orders. But Amazon or your local bookstore can get it for you, probably your best bets.
The book, Commander of the Faithful, A Story of True Jihad, The Life and Times of Amir Abd el-Qadr. The handsome devil, wasn't he? Yeah.
Well, it was actually an imaginary painting by Horace Vernet, but he was often compared by, the one general who met him, General Bugeaud, described him as a Muslim Jesus.
Well, I was going to say, I'm just looking at the portrait there, and he's Jesus with a better beard.
Yeah, yeah, and with a sort of gray-blue eyes, and but he had, people met him in the field, and there weren't that many who did, it was Bugeaud and priests, they always were struck by how monk-like he looked. He didn't have weapons and bandoliers and, you know, any of the accoutrements of war. He just, you know, usually found him sitting under a, you know, an olive tree.
Well, John Kaiser, thank you very much for dropping by. I do appreciate your time. I can't wait to read the book.
Well, would you like to have my publisher send you?
I would love that.
Do you have a card?
I do indeed. Stand by and let me go fishing here.
Send you a few books, and maybe you can see. Where are you based out of?
We're out of West Virginia.
West Virginia. Okay.
And you're a gentleman farmer, are you?
I'm
not?
A gentleman farmer in Rappahannock County.
Okay.
Not
okay.
Too far from Front Royal. And
yeah, we're down in the Southern Coalfields area, and in the middle of the Whitewater Tourism. Area.
Well, my daughter spent almost a year down in the Canaan Valley.
Okay. Beautiful country there.
Yeah. The Horn. Great. I mean, they got liberals down in that part of Virginia.
Don't tell them. They'll run me out. You know, burn a question mark in my yard or something.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's a liberal anyway? It's all everything. It's
I just like to think of myself as a guy who actually thinks about things.
Yeah, well, you know what I've decided of all the seven deadly sins, I think the deadliest is laziness, sloth, and it's mental laziness.
Oh, absolutely.
People don't want to make distinctions. They don't want to deal with complexity.
In your farming career, what do you raise?
Pigs.
Yum. Call me.
Pigs, and we also, mostly it's crops that I have somebody else farm. Pigs are kind of my little hobby.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
So if you ever down around Sperryville coming over visiting, give
absolutely
us a call.
Absolutely will. John, yeah. Thank you so very much. It was a great conversation.
Well, thank you.
I thank you. As we continue, that of course, John Kaiser. And again, seriously, this book just gets... I'm such a history geek.
Well, good. Well, you have to be interested in history because you can't really appreciate a story without putting it in a historical context. But it's really it's a kind of a faith in action story wrapped in a clash of civilization story. You So I think it is quite
and relevant to our times in the extreme.
Very. And as I say, these people exist today, and we have to engage with them. They're not quite as famous, but they're out there.
And worth the effort. Thank you very kindly.
No, thank
have
you.
A great day and a great afternoon.
Now, wait a minute. Did you
No, that was on the floor.
I put it in my wallet.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's see. About 5 minutes before the hour, and you know what? Schedule management is not my bag. You guys know, you listen. We do long form. We're not very good at short form. But we've got more conversations scheduled very soon. And you know what? At some point, I'm going to grab a couple of snaps of just the goings on and doings here, just to give you a visual impression of what is happening. My audience. Yeah. Myself.
That sounds so intimate and familiar.
We try to make it work that way. Yeah. Now, we call what we do conversation radio, not talk radio. So, well, I just got so tired, John, of hearing, that's enough about you. Let's talk about me. Hey, yeah. And we'll be right back after this ad for a gold purchasing scam.
Yeah, no. You know, when I was in France, one of the things that really impressed me was the way presidential and political candidates were interviewed. They sit at a table, two of them together, and they would have an hour long discussion. It wasn't like, you know, throw out a question, give me an hour. They actually came to grips and they talked in a civilized
and processed
way.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we try not to be a life support system for the latest patent herbal medicine advertisement.
Right. Yeah. Well, good.
Well, thank you, and good luck. Good luck talking with the other folks.
We can find an excuse to talk about the book when you go back to Virginia.
I'll find an especially good excuse if your publisher gets me a copy, because I'll be babbling about it for months.
Great. Okay.
I hang on to good books like a dog does to a bone. Okay. Thanks, John. So we are coming up on the close of our first hour. I am mercifully still alive, and I have not done the vampire trick whereby, since I work at night, I've been working in the sunshine, I've turned to dust or anything, which is encouraging. Just to give you a sense of where I am, there is a beautiful swimming pool immediately behind me. And it just says leap in me all over. And at some point, I might. Trying to figure out what happens with my... we are officially a half hour behind. So I would imagine coming up at about 5 minutes past one, we will be talking with one of the preeminent liberal progressive economists in the country, that being Dean Baker. Looking forward to that a great deal. And I probably need a couple of minutes just to chase down schedules and see who is where and doing which.
Here, I can set you up.
Let me. Yeah. Hey, Bob, kill that microphone. Yeah, okay. So it's a little bit more quiet. This is a wonderful event. We're coming to you live from the Progressive Media Row at the Campaign for America's Future. Our future now being the theme. And on the schedule for later this afternoon, Dean Baker, Bob Amsterdam, Solange Hansen, Kim Bobo, Eric Bollert, with whom you are familiar. Excuse me. And my colleague Rick Smith is here. No.
Sorry, didn't mean.
No. You're not interrupting. Jump behind a microphone. We've got a second here. I wouldn't have recognized you, Rick.
Well, you can see the picture on my website.
From the Horn Weekend, Rick Smith of the Rick Smith Show, out of generally speaking, the Harrisburg area, right?
Correct.
When did you get here? Tell a guy you're going to be here. We would have made table space for you, brother.
You know, I just made the plan here this morning. Woke up 5 o'clock this morning. Said, you know what? I think I want to go. And I got in the car, drove right down here, and this is where I'm at.
Well, wonderful. Look, we're going to be here. Are you going to be here for the 3 days?
Yep, I'm going to be here.
Okay, so don't be a stranger. If you want to, I don't know, maybe one of these evenings, you, me, Guy James, Mark Levine, we'll get four microphones fired up, and we'll round table the dickens out of this thing.
That sounds like a great thing. Good luck to you.
What a great first meeting, Rick.
Yep,
take
we'll
care.
See you.
Dean, I'm so pleased to meet you. I've read your work. If you want to work a little bit early, sidle right up, and we'll get after it.
Sure. What time did you have down?
I had you down for 1:05.
Oh, okay. Well, it was an hour. Sorry. Had to race down here from my office.
Oh, no worries at all. No worries at all. Forgive me, but you're like an economic Elvis to me, so, you know. I really, really appreciate your work with us. And I'm sorry, this is radio, and I should be doing a better job at making people understand what's going on here. We're working live, so, you know, without a net. Dean Baker is with us right now. Just a little bit of background bio on Dean, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research here in D.C., and not necessarily citing the competition, but when it comes to liberal or progressive economic matters, you and Paul Krugman are the people who are mentioned in the same breath together, and or frequently. And especially in the last few months. I mean, you were one of the people who were screaming that the barn was on fire for the last 8 years. And now that we've had a couple of months of the Obama administration, is there any water being put on the barn, or is it?
It's a very mixed story. I mean, some of the things, you know, they passed the stimulus package just after they got in office, which was good. It was very good. It wasn't big enough, but it was the right thing to do. It was a big step in the right direction. They are talking about making some of the changes to the regulatory structure. But I think at the bottom line is, in terms of changing the factors that got us here, they haven't really stepped up to the plate. And I really do worry that we're going to end up with the exact same sort of financial structure that we had before the collapse, with some cosmetic changes. And no one's really being held account. I mean, I people think I'm being vindictive on this. I wrote a piece just this morning, a blog post about firing Ben Bernanke. You know, everyone I know, I don't really personally know Bernanke. I met him, but I don't really know him. Everyone I know says he's a great guy. I'm sure he is. But the point was, if you want people not to make the same mistakes again, they have to be held accountable. And there's absolutely...
Or maybe they have to not be the same people.
Well, that's both of those. I mean, both of those. I would say yes. You don't... I was saying this only somewhat facetiously. Ben Bernanke is like the school bus driver who drunkenly plows into the oncoming traffic and kills all the passengers on his bus. I mean, this is really bad. And if you just let him go on and just say everything's fine, well...
He's going to do it again.
He's going to do it again, and the next person's going to do it again.
And Dean, at what point do you think the American people, and maybe this is part of the purview of what you do, at what point do we teach the American people to stop tolerating it? Because, you know, I mean, you know, go back to Alan Greenspan. After all of this burn, after the barn burns down, he says, "I'll be damned. There was a fire in the barn," and it's like we're supposed to think it's all right. It's not all right.
It's not all right. And what they're doing, it's really fascinating and depressing. But what they're doing is trying to cover up the fact that this was easy, it was preventable, it was foreseeable. So what they focus on, I hear people talking about it as a financial crisis. I never use that term. I talk about it as an economic crisis, because the financial crisis, the financial aspect is really secondary. The whole point was we had an economy that was driven by a housing bubble. It should have been easy for a professional economist like Alan Greenspan to see that we had a housing bubble. We had a huge divergence in house prices from a 100-year-long trend with no explanation. That doesn't just happen. So it should have been easy for him to see that, and it should have been easy for him to recognize that the collapse of the housing bubble would have disastrous consequences for the economy. You don't hear that talked about, though. Instead, you hear talk about the financial aspects, the complex derivative instruments, the credit default swaps. People don't understand
that.
And
it totally lost me.
Exactly. And that's exactly what they want. They want everyone to think that this is a very, very complex issue. No one really could have foreseen it. And you can't hold these people accountable when, in fact, at the most basic level, the housing bubble, this was arithmetic. You have a 100-year-long trend in the largest market in the country, the housing market. We get a sharp divergence. There's no explanation. valuation for it. That's a bubble. When that bubble bursts, you're talking about $8 trillion of wealth disappearing. That's a disaster.
And I want to talk about this idea of disappearing wealth in a minute. But when you talk about this, you know, they want people to say, well, you know, nobody could have foreseen it. Is that sort of solipsistic, legalistic butt covering, you know, that as long as it's not, you know, because in order to be sued, the harm has to have been reasonable and foreseeable. Ah, God, nobody could have foreseen this. And so that by creating that whole mythical universe, they set up a world whereby maybe we don't want to get the pitchforks and the torches after them.
That's exactly it. So they're trying to make this sound very complicated, and, you know, yeah, hindsight's 20/20. I have a lot of people tell me that. I love that. I go, yeah, well, I'll show you my 20/20 written in 2002.
Yeah, your 2020 foresight.
Yeah, right, yeah, right, you know, sure. but that's exactly what they want. They want to portray this as something very complicated, and yeah, you know, if someone had really been brilliant, they would have been able to see it, but the fact is, we're mortals, we just missed it.
But you didn't.
No, and as I say, the whole point was it was very, very simple. So it wasn't that I was so prescient. It was just really just basic common sense. And the problem is that we had people running the show who either had no common sense or were willing to ignore what common sense would have told them.
Or were having too much fun involving themselves in the dodge in the first place.
People were making a fortune on this. So what I would have wanted them to do was to tell Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and the rest, you know, this is not going to continue. This bubble is going to burst, and I'm going to do everything I can to make it burst. If I have to raise interest rates to 20% and that wrecks your bank, I'm going to do that.
To what extent does that level of financial nepotism play in this? I mean, aren't there any ethical rules out there, or did they just go out the window with the Bush administration's treatment
of
the market?
Well, unfortunately, it goes deeper than the Bush administration. The Federal Reserve Board, which is a central actor here, has always been close to the financial industry. It is by design, and this is one of the things people should understand. The Federal Reserve Board, which sets our monetary policy, it's our main regulator, it should be a public organization.
Yes.
But only a fraction of it is actually public in the sense that these are people appointed through the democratic system. The bulk of the people in policymaking positions in the Federal Reserve Board are actually appointed by the banks. So this didn't begin with Bush. This dates back, you know, Federal Reserve Board's been there almost 100 years.
Right,
that's a really big problem.
And you just told me something, and I mean, I'm not a moron or anything, but you just told me something I don't know.
Very few people understand this, and it's kind of striking. You know, with the bailouts, we've had $700 billion going out through the TARP. That was approved by Congress and
right.
sent out through the Treasury. Over $2 trillion has been lent out by the Federal Reserve Board. Now, with the TARP, there have been all sorts of issues. The accountability's not been great, but in principle, I can go up on the web and see how much did Citigroup get, how much did
right.
Goldman get, what were the terms exactly. What happened to $2 trillion in the Fed? We don't know. They have like 13 different windows. We could find out $400 billion went through one window, $200 billion through another. Who got it? We don't
What's
know.
On the other end of the window? I mean,
we don't. That's
it's,
all
It's not
secret.
Enough to know that there's a window.
It's all secret. And what's remarkable is that there's a proposal. There's a bill in Congress being sponsored, interestingly, by Ron Paul, you know, the
mm-hmm.
libertarian.
Right, right.
And co-sponsored by Grayson from South Carolina, one of the mm-hmm. more progressive members of Congress. It now has about 180 signatures that would have the government accountability office audit the Fed. But what's remarkable has been the hostility to this. All you're talking about is having a government agency audit our nation's central bank. That shouldn't be a radical proposition. But you go around raising that in Washington circles, people look at you like you're talking about burning down the country or something.
Well, for purposes of the activism of the people in this audience, can you give do you have a bill number, title?
You know, if you look up on Grayson's website, I'm sorry, I actually don't know. I'm drawing a blank on both
That's
the number
okay.
and the name. But if you look on Grayson, or you could go to Ron Paul's website. I mean,
oh,
you know,
okay,
this
sure.
case is on the right side.
Yeah.
You know, and absolutely, if people would get behind this. And remarkably, about 3/4 of the sponsors at this point are Republicans. So we really need some Democrats to jump on board and be sponsors.
Is there... You know, as I've watched this unfold, I know more history than I do economics. Economics and electricity are two things that I know enough to know that I can hurt myself. But you talked about the housing bubble, Dean. Is this a modern version of the Dutch tulip collapse? I mean, were our economics, the infrastructure. so engaged, whether it be the housing bubble or in this case, you know, looking at the lovely tulips, that they didn't understand that, for instance, where the tulips were, they were genetically engineering themselves right out of a market, yeah. And that's what was going on with the Dodges in the house. Were they mesmerized by their own hoodoo?
Well, you know, you don't have to go too far back. Remember in the 90s, we had the stock bubble. And you
sure.
had people buying up internet stocks of companies that weren't making a profit and didn't even know how they would make a profit and paying hundreds of millions of dollars for the stocks issues of those companies.
Sure.
So it was the same sort of thing. It was this totally irrationality that people would just say, well, house prices never fall. I debated the chief economists from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the National Association of Realtors, the Mortgage Bankers Association. They would all tell people, house prices never fall. And just go, where did you get this? Is this some, you know, the message
who
from God?
You,
you know, who, you know, did your mother tell you when you're growing up? I mean, where did you get this? But they would say this with great conviction, you know, and they're good. They're good spokespeople. You know, they go out there, they go, look, I've been in housing for, you know, 20, 30 years, and I can tell you house prices have never.
There's never been a better time to buy real estate than now.
And that's what they would say. It was really funny. I got a big kick out of this because David Lira was the chief spokesperson, economist for the National Association of Realtors. You know, afterwards, of course, you know, people have jumped on him, and he said, well, what do you expect? I was working for the realtors. And to a certain extent, I'm sympathetic to him in the sense that, yeah, he was working for the realtors. The ones who were really, really bad were the reporters who just wrote down what David Lira said though this guy's a neutral figure.
But, you know, you talk about the possible reform at the Fed or the auditing of the Fed. Isn't there some sort of mechanism whereby we make people like that walk around with a big blinking ethical light around them saying, I am not impartial, I am an advocate, whether it's a disclosure issue or the media?
Well, there are two different stories. On the one hand, the people, David Lira was walking around with that light. The reporters just chose not to see it. I mean, this guy's, he's works for the realtors, so there's no mistake. He's not giving you his honest assessment of the housing market. He's telling you what the realtors want you to hear. On the other hand, the Fed officials, these people are supposed to work for us, and that is the big scandal. They're not supposed to be the buddies of the New York bankers. They're supposed to be working for the public. They're supposed to be working to have the economy as a whole work well, not have it work for Wall Street. And that's where the real scandal is.
Structurally speaking, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Madison, the gang, did not sit down and come up with the Fed. In fact, if I recall my American history correctly, there was substantial bad feelings over how we treat money in the new country, you know, between the Madisons and the Hamiltons and the Burrs and
exactly.
so forth. You and I have spoken of questions regarding a reform of the Fed. I'm getting a query from our chat room. Would we be better off, is this something that is so broken it can't be fixed? Do we throw it out and have done with it and try something new? I mean, is the Fed the problem in itself?
Well, the Fed is a really big problem as it's structured. We need a central bank. So do we change the name? If that would make people feel better, fine. I mean, I know Newt Gingrich, when the Republicans took over Congress, he hated the Healthcare Financing Administration.
Right.
So they changed the name to Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. As best I could tell, it's the exact same organization. But, you know, I don't know if changing the name will do anything. But what we really need to do is change the governance structure. The Fed has to be answerable to Congress, to the president. It doesn't mean I'll have arguments with my friends in the economics profession that go, oh, you want Congress setting interest rates? No. No, I just want the people who set interest rates to be fully answerable to Congress. They should use their best judgment, but it should be Congress, the President and Congress that appoints them, just like the Supreme Court.
Sure.
You know, the Supreme Court will make decisions that I won't like or members of Congress won't like. We recognize the importance of having an independent judiciary. Same thing with the Fed. But that doesn't mean we want the banks appointing the Supreme Court, nor do we want the banks picking the people who run the Fed.
And is it that more private than public aspect of the Fed that creates the greatest number of problems?
It's certainly a very, very big contributor. The New York Times had a great piece about Timothy Geithner, the current Treasury Secretary, who previously had been president of the New York Fed. And it talked about how he would go to meetings all the time with the CEOs at Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. And there was this idea that, you know, they're friends, they're all part of the club. I'm sure he saw nothing improper with it. So I don't mean to accuse him of any impropriety.
No,
but the point is that those are his friends. And they really, I mean, I don't care if he wants to have lunch with these guys. guys occasionally, but he doesn't work for them. It has to be understood. He works for the public. If you happen to have lunch with these guys, like you might have lunch with someone else every now and then, that's fine. But that's not your job. Your job is not to have lunch with Citigroup and Goldman Sachs and see what they want.
Is the talent pool for the people who can do this job as shallow as what it appears to be? And just by way of explaining what I mean by that, it seems like Republican or Democrat, in large part, it's always round up the usual suspects, that there's only a limited number of people who can do that. But that's just cronyism, isn't it? I mean,
well, it really ends up being that way. And the issue is that when you talk about the level of technical expertise that you might want someone who's on the Fed or at Treasury to have, the vast majority of people who have that level of technical expertise will either be at Wall Street, will have done work with Wall Street. It's very hard to find someone who is independent. Even the academics, a lot of them have done consulting for Wall Street. You know, Larry Summers, it comes out, sure, he's gotten $7 million. And again, I don't think that directly influences opinion. I don't think it was a bribe, but on the other hand, says a lot that he was sufficiently tied to these people. He got $7 million for that. I mean, I always say, imagine the other way around. You know, I'm more labor-friendly. Imagine the UAW had me $7 million, then you're going to have me as a consultant on the auto bailout.
Sure.
You know, everyone, that would raise eyebrows.
Yeah, it would indeed. To what extent can we make this structure, I mean, is the word not-for-profit just anathema within a discussion of how we do our central banking in the country?
The central bank is not supposed to be making a profit. So that really, that's, in fact, beyond a certain amount. They give most of their money that they earn back to the federal government. So that really shouldn't be the issue. It's pure and simply, are the people who are responsible for running the Fed appointed, approved by Congress and the President, or do we give most of the control to the banks? And as it stands now, it's very clear. I mean, it's not conspiracy. You could look it up on the Fed website. No. How do these people get appointed? It's by the banks.
So how do you get rid of a Ben Bernanke?
It's Congress. Congress would have to take the leadership and say, we're going to restructure the Fed. We're going to say that these people have to be appointed by the President, approved by Congress. That's it.
So are you, in terms of like the audit bill that you mentioned, I mean, have you read the thing?
It's very simple. Yeah, it's just that you know, basically gives the Government Accountability Office instructions to audit the Fed.
So it would work for you.
Well, it's a start. I mean, this is really just a foot in the door. I mean, because hopefully the next step is with more awareness of what the Fed's doing that we will be able to get legislation to get more control over it. But that's really just the first step.
Okay, as we wrap up here, what's the future? What's your immediate future advocacy? Where is Dean Baker's mind as we look at the status of the economy today?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, obviously, healthcare's got to be front and center. You know, what goes on with the bailouts? I certainly hope we don't give even more money to the banks. But what we really need is another big stimulus, because it's clear the stimulus that we have...
And it has to go to the right place this
time.
It
has to go to the right place, yeah. So we need another big stimulus package to get the economy going again.
Dean Baker, thank you so much. It's an honor and a privilege.
Thanks a lot. Really enjoyed it.
Take care.
I'm taking up your seat. Taking up your seat?
No, I'm taking you to the next show.
Yeah, you were being marshaled. Guess who's here, everybody? Guy James is in the house. So is Mark Levine. We're all here. Let's see. I bet I can make this. You know, I'm so good.
It looks like it works already.
Well, it works for you. Got to make one work for Guy.
Oh, that's a problem.
Have Mike will travel, man.
Hello, Horn listeners who are here early.
They're not here early.
You're here early.
I'm here on time.
I mean early for usual Horn time.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant that maybe I was just sort of extraneous and everybody's waiting.
No. I meant that we're not usually on at this hour, Bob. Don't be so defensive now.
I've traveled. I'm sensitive. I'm out of my element. I'm out of the hills.
I know. And you should see, folks, all these cords around here. We've got like 50 cords all tangled up in one huge mess. I don't know. And a mixer that looks like it could, I don't know, invade Iraq.
And
what's that, a ton? That mixer?
Hey, how are you?
Hey. Oh, and I see a friend of mine.
Oh, let's see here. Let's get
my local TV producer is here, Jim Southworth.
And there is Guy James, I do believe.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah, that is Guy James.
I'm not staying long. You could give him my mic even after you just worked him in.
Well,
so
no,
nicely.
But we're sort of roundtabling here. So
all
that's
right.
Cool.
Well, that works.
But you've got other stuff to do. What are you doing right now?
Well, I'm going to pre-tape some interviews starting at 2:00.
Mm-hmm.
that I will weed out and only play the interesting ones for listeners, because dirty little secret, they're not all that good. Many are wonderful.
I've had great ones so far.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
They gave me the good ones.
Well, yeah, they like you better than me, Bob. That's obvious. Or maybe it's just the orange shirt. You scare them.
Yeah, but I don't have the hair products, man. You got me whipped.
It comes with my people. Anyway. So I'm going to pre-tape some interviews and then go live from 5 to 6 with whatever they give me live, or I'll play some of my pre-tapes.
Because we're right here. You know where the table is. Don't get lost.
No, I'm going to come here. I'll do the show live from here.
Okay.
But I'm going to pre-tape somewhere else so that we're not talking at the same time, et cetera.
Very good. Very good. See you, Mark.
All right.
Hey, Jim.
How you doing, my friend?
See you, brother. Well, so how was the flight? You just flew in from Florida, and boy, are your arms tired.
Everything was perfect. My God, what an easy trip today. Very easy trip.
Isn't it beautiful out there?
Left early, got in early.
The only thing, we don't have a parade of bikini-clad maidens at the pool out there.
Yeah,
somebody dropped the ball.
This is a different area we had this in than it was
last
year.
Really?
It was over there, over yonder, last year.
Right.
We didn't have the bikini. I'll see what I can round up over there.
Would you work on that, please?
Yes, I will.
Yeah. Isn't Dean Baker great?
Yeah, he is. He really is. He's.
And this whole thing is like a parade of smart people.
Oh yeah, I see lots of people we're familiar with here today. Tom Hartman's here, and another friend of mine from Florida's here, and Katrina Van de Heuvel just walked by from the Nation.
I got to get so much better at this because I'm not good at spotting the fabulous like you are.
Well,
because that's because I haven't hung around.
Fabulosity is my game.
Yeah. Well, you yes, exactly.
Other than that, I don't have anything going.
Well, let's see. I'm waiting. I'm waiting for Bob Amsterdam and I may have talked myself right out of my Jane Hampshire interview. That's the other thing. You know, I'm kind of new. I'm new to this whole gig. You've done this for eons. But you've got to really be a merciless time manager for this, don't you?
Oh yeah, Candy and Lavisa and Stephanie and everybody that sets this thing up, they marshal everybody in and out of here. I mean, if they're not right on time, they come and snatch them right out of the chair.
Well, and that's what just happened with Dean.
Yeah, well, Dean's a popular guest.
It's tough though because the way I'm used to operating, you've got a reasonable amount of time to really do depth on a topic, and not so much.
You're going to do the outline today.
Yeah, right. Yeah, today's Cliff's. This is Cliff's Notes Broadcasting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No typical Bob in depth interviews.
Let me see if I can flag this gentleman. All right, we're getting some of this sorted out, but you and I can kill time with the best of them, guy.
Oh, it's pain alone, Bob. They have dozens and dozens of guests, and some of them cancel at the last moment, and you don't, and you've boned up on some of your guests and done research on them, and they come in at the last minute and say, and it's not their fault. I mean, it's not their fault at all. And they come in and say, well, so and so's not coming. Here's Joe. Hi, Joe. Who are you?
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm particularly persnickety about, guys, is that if somebody provides me with a book, I read the book before I
get
it. Because I hate using the little PR Cliff's Notes.
Yeah.
Because that means
ask these questions.
Yeah, that means it sounds like every other interview the poor soul
does.
Exactly. And having read enough from people who do tours and things like that, I know they get tired of the same questions. So I try to come up with some different ones. And I just had an author of a fascinating book. And I would love to have had an advance copy of it to read it because the topic was so engaging.
That's one thing in our business. We do have a lot of books to read.
Yes, we do. And
I got four or five this past week, and I haven't been able to touch any of them yet.
Well, I've got one coming on the future of labor, and that's a little light reading by the pool.
So, still checking. Yeah,
I've got. Oh, now wait a minute. We've got score
first bikini.
Two there. There's one right beside the other.
Okay, we have two bikinis.
You're gonna think where some of them there are preverts if we keep talking like
that's
that.
That's okay. I mean, you know, it's the bikini count. It's live radio. Yeah.
You don't ordinarily think of Washington D.C. as bikini town.
See, I'm only no, but we know better. I can only say this because I'm pretty sure my wife isn't listening. Nobody tattle, okay? I'm screwed. I got, of course, I packed up and came over here this morning, Guy, and have you checked in?
Yeah.
Okay, because they looked at me like I had two heads, so, like.
I told them to do that.
Oh, okay, because I need, like, the Holy Writ or the wand or something waved over me to.
My flight took off at 9:42 from Fort Myers. I got in over here. It was supposed to land at 12:06. I arrived here at the hotel at 10 after 12.
Oh, my God, you got a flight that was ahead of schedule?
Ahead of schedule. I jumped on the Metro, bang, zoom, got the room, went up and unpacked all my clothes, ironed a couple of things, took a nap.
Where are we?
We're up on the 8th floor.
Oh, no kidding, with a view and everything?
Not much of a view this time. Not much of a view. Last year I had a view of Woodley Park and all that. This year I got a view of
across
the New Heights restaurant across, which, by the way, is
very nice.
Quite good.
Oh, yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Did you check out a little bit of the news this morning or anything?
News?
Yeah, before you, the GM bankruptcy.
Susan Boyle's in the hospital.
Yeah. do I hit you with the cheap Sony microphone
I
or the expensive Sherwin?
I listened to talk radio on the way up or down. Yeah, up. I'm listening to that.
What is the right wing rot about today?
They seem to be disturbed, and I just hadn't heard this. They seem to be disturbed about the Supreme Court nominee for some reason.
I'll bet it's because she's a racist.
Oh, man. Let him go.
Yeah.
Feed him more rope.
Yeah, yeah. Go, guys. Yeah, say it some more. Yeah. Just.
I love it. I do.
It astonishes me, though. I mean, because the one thing that's been on my mind since I read about it yesterday, yesterday was my travel day, and this business of, this is the second. I don't know how else to put it, Guy. This is the second summer in a row where they're attacking us in our churches.
Oh, yeah.
Solange, please sit down. Yes. Oh, okay, that's fine. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Make sure he stays on
message. Oh, no, we do conversations here. It goes all over the place. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, I'm Bob Kincaid. Welcome to The Horn, America's liberal voice. There's a set of headphones there for you if you would like. And I had initially been scheduled to speak with, and it is Solange, is that correct? Solange Hansen. You are with Public Campaign.
Public Campaign,
is that correct?
That's right. I'm the president of Public Campaign.
And you are deep in the trenches of social change. What is number one priority? What brings you here? What are you hoping to highlight? What do you want people to know?
Well, I think one thing that the big issues that are being talked about here have in common is that they all pit consumer interests or the voices of ordinary people against status quo-oriented vested interests that don't want change. So whether you're looking at financial regulation or health care reform or energy reform, in every case you have the voices of ordinary people and you have the vested interest campaign contributors, the big lobbying interests. And I think we'd like to see that equation a little different. We'd like to see members of Congress not having to rely on those special interests when they need to raise $1 million or $10 million to run for office. So we support publicly financed elections.
Okay, I was going to say, so is the answer to that to build a better internet mousetrap where we get more $5 ordinary Joe contributions, or is it to change the system entirely and get the dirty money out of it?
Well, you need a combination of those small contributions, the voices of ordinary people, but they don't add up to enough. I mean, Barack Obama would not be president if he relied only on small money. He raised more small money than anybody ever did, and more big money than anybody ever did. If you really want to rely on small voices, you have to have matching public funds to go along with the $5 and $10 and $25 contributions. Right now, there's a bill that's been introduced in the House and the Senate called the Fair Elections Now Act, and it would provide public financing for people who want to run for Congress, but no contributions more than $100 would be allowed.
Is it a voluntary program?
It's voluntary. It needs to be voluntary in order to be constitutional, or at least the way this court would interpret the Constitution.
Well, I'm out of West Virginia, and we introduce year after year after year the clean elections bill, and we make a little progress as time goes on, but we are certainly nowhere near where we need to be. But that's a structure, if I understand it correctly, Nick. Whereby matching funds or publicly financed funds can be given to a candidate on a voluntary basis. There's nothing to say that if you want to be the really dirty corporate client who takes filthy, filthy money, that you can't have it by the boatload. They can deliver it every day in Brinks trucks.
Up to the limits on contributions. There are laws that actually limit contributions, but there's no laws that says you can only spend so much. So what we've done is devised a public system that would make it so there is another way. And if you were publicly financed based on small contributions, you could actually compete with that person who has boatloads of big special interest money.
And doesn't it also, or at least isn't part of the hope behind public financing of campaigns, that it will bring a genetic sea change to the political class itself, that it will bring different people into politics who have not heretofore been involved with it?
That's right. And in fact, there are systems like the one being proposed at the federal level that are actually in action in Maine and Arizona and Connecticut. In all those states, the legislatures are elected through a system like this, and also the statewide folks. And you find people running for office who never would have made it because they didn't have financial connections running, and a lot of them win.
Have you tracked what happens to the political landscape in places like Maine, Arizona, Connecticut, in terms of what kind of legislation you get being brought into the public sphere after something like clean elections is brought in?
Well, you can take a look at Governor Janet Napolitano's reign as Arizona governor. She was elected using the clean elections system twice, and she talked about not having to pay attention to the lobbyists come budget time, because they hadn't funded her campaign. If she'd been elected under the conventional system, she might have felt the pressure to pay back some IOUs. And the Arizona state budget provided more money than ever had before for education, for instance, funding kindergarten, full-day kindergarten statewide. In her first budget, there were a lot of differences that hadn't been pushed before. In Connecticut this year, they were looking around. They had a huge budget deficit and were looking ways to fill that. And the liquor and beverage wholesaler industry has always kept those nickels that aren't collected by the public.
Right.
And it had been taboo. People tried for years and years to collect that. But the biggest lobbying interests in the state were represented at the Capitol, and those people were big fundraisers. So all of a sudden in Connecticut, they did two things. One, they said lobbyists can't give it to political candidates anymore. And second, they said since that'll take so much of your money away, we're actually going to provide you with public financing. Well, this is the first time that that money went back into the public coffers instead of being kept by the private interests.
That's fascinating. So is there a lot of difference between these state-level programs, as you've described and we've discussed here? Is there a great deal of difference between those and the proposal for the federal level?
Well, the scale's a bit different. And in Maine or Arizona or Connecticut, it's not typical for a legislator to need to raise $1 million as you have to do for the House of Representatives. So it's magnified, and you need to get even more people involved in your campaign with small donations. But it's only because they represent more voters. So you have larger districts. It will happen on a larger scale. And I also think that what's at stake nationally right now, state policy can only go so far as to on climate change, for instance,
certainly.
Or a health care reform. We need to look at that nationally. So when you look at the big national issues, and you look at how they're being played out right now. So, for instance, you had Senator Dick Durbin, who's the sponsor of the Fair Elections Now Act in the Senate, saying the banks own this place, frankly. And that was after a measure to protect consumers people are being foreclosed on was squashed in the U.S. Senate by banking interests. And then this morning in the New York Times, Representative Colin Peterson was quoted saying the banks run the place, talking about the House.
Yeah.
And he was chair of the Agriculture Committee. and he wanted to have the derivatives be regulated by a commission that would actually pay attention and regulate it closely, while the banks wanted to be regulated under the Fed, and they felt like they were pretty lax. So the banks won out, and this morning's quote was, "The banks run this place."
Yeah, they always the house always wins. You know, that's they don't hang that sign in front of the casino in Vegas,
And this is pretty remarkable because we just had a change election.
Right.
These are
right.
Democratic leaders who are part of an expanded majority. You would think that they actually run the place, and maybe the voters own the place. But they're being frustrated and stymied by the special interests. The banks gave hundreds of millions of dollars in the last election.
Well, let's be honest. How much is stymie and how much is willing accomplice? Because I mean, you and I could probably just on our fingertips tick off the people who are leaders of the liberal movement, leaders of the progressive movement inside the House, and might have to look a little harder to find them inside the Senate. But there's an awful lot of those people who fight tooth and toenail against the stuff that you and I would call real liberalism or real progressivism, and they've still got a D behind their name.
I think there's a turning point that's happened on that. So you have people like Senator Durbin who said to us, the reform community, he said, you know, 5 years ago I wouldn't have been leading on legislation like this, but I think it's necessary right now because I can't do my job. I can't help my colleagues craft good legislation as long as they have to be out fundraising all the time. And he said, you have no choice but to spend your time fundraising and pay attention to the people who can write big checks. And I want to change that. And so I think if you give people a choice between courting the wealthy interests at fancy cocktail parties in Washington, D.C., or spending more time with their constituents, the people who put them in the first place, for a lot of them that's an easy choice. They'd rather spend the time with the constituents.
Really? I mean,
There are certain people.
I'm a cynic.
I know there are.
This is a nice town.
Right. But if you ask people what the least favorite part of their job is, mm-hmm. I bet you 90% of the elected lawmakers say it's the fundraising I have to do day and night, week in, week out.
Wasn't it the Democratic senator from South Carolina who just a few years back when he got out? Fritz Hollings, who said all the fun had been taken out of senatoring by the fact that he was constantly out there hustling for a buck.
That's right. I mean, if you set up watch and watch where the lawmakers go after they adjourn or take a break, it's across the street to the DCCC headquarters, the Republican Committee headquarters, to make call after call after call. Those guys don't want to do that.
It really must be a miserable experience. This is present. This legislation is present in. It's been introduced. It has co-sponsors.
That's right. In the Senate, it's being led by. We thought we had bipartisan co-sponsorship at the top. We had Senator Durbin and Senator Spector, but now we have two Democrats at the top. We're hoping to bring some more Republicans on board. And in the House, it's the fourth-ranking leader, Democratic leader in the House, U.S. Representative John Larson from Connecticut, where they have this system in place. And this is different. This is having leaders say it's time for a change, not mavericks or people on the outs with leadership, but people actually leading and have the caucus behind them.
Not Ron Paul.
We got to change. Right. That's right.
I'm sorry. I guess that's terribly cynical of me, but.
Well, this is why we think there is a really good chance to win this in the next couple of years, and it's because the people who are taking a lead on this
Does it have a bill number
folks.
Or anything like that?
Yes, it does. In the Senate, it's Senate Bill 752.
Okay.
In the House, it's 1826. It's the Fair Elections Now Act.
All right. And do you have any co-sponsor numbers right now?
We just have a handful, and they were just introduced near the beginning of April, and the numbers are beginning to grow up. We actually think by the end of the summer we'll be well over half of what we need to win the bill in the House and probably in
what
the Senate
committee
as
was
well.
It what committee was it introduced in?
It's going to the Governmental Affairs Committee.
Okay. I merely ask because you know that's an obvious means of targeting a targeting passage. One hopes.
Well, we have a website, fairelectionsnow.org, and people can go there and find out the answers to all these questions. They can find out if their own lawmaker has signed on, and we'll keep people up to date about the committees that's going through in the House and the Senate.
Now you talk. I mean, we've obviously there's a thrust that is geared toward the means by which we. Pay for elections. The other connection is, of course, the straight up issue of should elected representatives be allowed to take
PAC money? Should they be allowed to take lobbyist money? Maybe I'm oversimplistic, Nick, okay? I was always taught that the simpler the law, the easier its enforcement and the easier its compliance. What is wrong, simply put, what is wrong with passing a law that says you don't get any more money outside your salary than what you're saying? I mean, that's what you get.
Well, you need some money to campaign with. So the question is, where should that come from? And I think...
Right, but that's what I'm asking. If we pass the clean elections,
right.
why then would it not be possible to pass legislation that says, you know, sorry, no more lobster lunches, no more, not, you know, and do it really straight up, mm-hmm. not no lobster lunches on days that don't end in Y.
Well, you know, you can try and squeeze the private interest money this way or that one way, but it's going to be around. What we're trying to do is offer them an alternative and say, if you go into this system, you can't take more than $100 from anybody. And that's a simple, flat-out law. I mean, mm-hmm. you take $101, you're violating the law.
What happens procedurally, Nick, when you've signed on to this program, you're doing the clean elections thing, and your opponent who takes, oh, let's say, millions of dollars in filthy coal money, okay, and he runs ads saying, my opponent won't stop having sex with farm animals, okay, and you need millions to counter that. What happens within that structure for that?
Well, I think the best thing you can do now is compare what happens now when that happens, which is you have to dig back deeper into your special interest money, the special interest money that backs you. And under this law, you'd dig back deeper into your constituents. You'd say to your rank-and-file supporters, I need your help to overcome this. If you give me $50, it qualifies for another $200 from the public fund. And so you go back and dig in deeper to your own supporters and
so
ask them to
support you. So there's not actually a tiered structure or an if-then sort of.
You mean if they're lying, I get extra money?
Well, no. I mean, there's obviously a primary. There's a primary fund, and then there's a general election fund, and then.
That's right. There's actually a qualifying fund first. You have to raise a certain amount of money in contributions
exactly.
Less than $100, and a number of contributions to qualify, and then you can take up to $100. Any individual in the primary, no organizational money at all, just individual money, and same in the general, and you get matching public funds to go with that.
Great. Nick, thank you so much. This actually is an issue that is near and dear to my heart. So I hope, do you have a card? Or,
I do.
I would appreciate it if you'd leave one with me because I'd like to follow the progress on it. We call what we do with the Horn America's Liberal Voice, we call it Activist Radio because it's something that I'm involved in. I'm an activist. Guy's an activist. The people who share their time listening to the Horn are activists. This is not a passive enterprise. So we would love to be part of helping you in the course of your work.
Well, I'd love to speak with you again.
All right.
Thanks.
I look forward to it. Nick Neihardt and Solange Hansen, who has worn her voice out, and we understand. But you're all part of the same fight.
Well, it is. It's remarkable, I think, when you look at the host of big issues where there are huge expectations about change. And most of the biggies are ones where the vested interest campaign money is weighing in big time.
It's what stops
the banks,
change.
But you can look at healthcare, the same sort of stuff.
Energy.
Energies, other environmental issues, too. When we get more into tax policy, you just go right down the line. And so many of the things where change has been promised are money issues, where there's a moneyed interest that's going to weigh in.
And they're the ones who stop it. So you're sort of dealing, your issue is one which is sort of at the forefront of, it's rather a sine qua non for everything else.
Well, if you look at the issues that are being raised here and look at the nature of the fight and who's on one side and who's on the other and then ask, well, which side the people here support, how much campaign money is given by that side versus the other side? And I think even when, you know, you have labor unions, powerful, well-established consumer organizations.
Well, I saw one thing where I guess the Markey Waxman bill, as it was making its way through, the industry outspent the people in favor of a sustainable planet by the tune of $69 to everyone we spent.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You look at that same kind of fight on the banking issue regulation, bank issues, but also all sorts of other financial regulation ones.
Okay.
So
well,
it's just going to be up and down the spectrum.
Well, we will work with you, and we hope we can be some help.
And where's your card?
My card. No, that's not me. That's just one we picked up off the floor.
Logo Daedalus and expert. What's a Logo Daedalus? But if I have one in my kitchen, I'm going to get an exterminator.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, we our field director is like favorite folks in the whole country are the activists in West Virginia who are working on this issue. She loves them.
They are good. They are dear friends of mine.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
And we actually got the woman who just got that, the Goldman Environmental Prize.
Maria Gonneau is a dear friend of mine.
She said, we asked her, and she said she'd do an op-ed that we'd get placed about if you want environmental progress, you also got to fight for campaign finance reform.
It's all true. The issues interlock with each other.
So thanks.
Well, thank you very much, and I wish you very well as you share your message. And you are Kim?
I am.
I am so glad to have you here.
Hi.
I'm Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Jump right in. I have one.
You have a bio in here or my high tech talking points?
Cool. There's a slim chance I'm happy to have the Cliffs notes, I gotta admit. Because some of this is so staccato and so rapid fire that you shift gears. No, I'm Bob Kincaid. You are presently live on the Horn, America's liberal voice. And you are, in fact, Kim Bobo. You are from Interfaith Worker Justice. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You are the founder thereof.
I am. I founded it.
And this goes back worker justice issues to what about 1996?
Yeah, that's right. I started it in 96 because the religious community was on the front lines of soup kitchens and shelters, and yet everybody knew people were in soup kitchens or shelters because they either didn't have jobs or didn't have jobs that paid enough. And yet, as the religious community, we weren't really doing anything on that. So I started building chapters around the country, and so we have 60 local chapters around the country that are engaging the religious community and fighting on these economic justice issues.
And is it ecumenical? It's not any particular faith.
That's correct. It's Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist.
Okay. And if you'd like, we've got headphones there for you if you'd like to be able to hear, or if not.
I can hear you just fine.
Oh, okay. Great. You are out of Chicago then?
I'm out of Chicago, headquartered there, but we have groups all over the country. And we also have 20 worker centers as well, where workers come in and they haven't been paid usually, and we engage the religious community. If sometimes there's enough of them that we can convince a union to organize them, which is the best thing. But more often, they have these problems and no union quite wants them because it's so small of a workplace. And so we work with them to try to fight back to get their wages back.
Is this a situation in which you're dealing more with immigrant workers, or is it spectrum-wide?
It's really, while I would say that most of our worker centers focus a lot on immigrant workers as the ones that are sort of least served in the society, the phenomena of wage theft is really across the board, and frankly, more wages are stolen from native-born workers than are stolen from immigrant workers
and
right
that
now.
And that is the heart and soul of what you advocate a lot for.
Absolutely,
and
right now.
Wage theft. Define wage theft.
Employers illegally stealing wages from workers, not paying people the minimum wage, not paying them overtime as required by the law, misclassifying them as independent contractors when they're really employees, stealing their tips, not paying their last paycheck. Anyway, it goes on and on in
this
terms of
like
how...
This sounds like a third world country.
It certainly does, but there are literally billions of dollars being stolen from millions of workers each and every year, and it is not, while it's worst in terms of the exploitation of immigrants, it's really not just an immigrant problem.
But I mean, I'm not skeptical. I'm not skeptical that it happens. I'm sure it does. But how does it happen? What are the mechanics by which? How do you get away with not paying somebody minimum wage? How do you get away with not paying somebody time and a half?
Well, okay, take the Saigon Grill in New York City. 36 delivery drivers work 70 to 80 hours a week in Manhattan delivering food for the Saigon Grill. They paid them a monthly salary of $520 a month. Do the math on that. It's $2 an hour is what those workers got paid.
Is this a function of worker desperation?
Or, I mean, you said it's broad spectrum. There are more domestic workers ripped off than immigrant workers. Why do people, is it ignorance? Why do people let this happen to themselves?
I don't think it's ignorance. I think it is, one, it's the fact that most workers are not represented by unions, and so they have no organized protection in the workplace. Secondly, the enforcement agencies have flat out dropped the ball. So you've got 750 investigators for the entire nation to enforce the Fair Labor Standards Act. That's one investigator for every 173,000 workers.
That's really not investigating,
is it? Obviously not. They sit on the phone and they handle a few calls, but they can't possibly protect us. You've got employer greed run rampant with no pushback against that. And as a result, workers feel like they're out there on their own. And frankly, many times they are. And employers off. I hear workers say all the time that their employers will say, look, you don't like the job? Go find another one. And in this
economy,
somebody
else wants this one.
That's right. In this economy, you know, everybody's holding. People often know their employers aren't paying them right, but you know a job is better than no job right now. And when you don't have
And what happens when the boss finds out you filed a Fair Labor Standards Act?
Well, because the retaliation provisions are so weak, probably you're going to get fired. Now you might get your job back, but it might take you a while. And who can afford that time in between?
Now this might be a little bit off the beaten path for something that, or for things that have been asked of you earlier. But is there a nexus for this for the wage theft issue for you? Does this become better if we manage to put enough starch into Harry Reid to get the Employee Free Choice Act passed?
Absolutely. Interfaith Worker Justice is a very strong supporter of the Employee Free Choice Act, not only because we believe in the rights of workers to organize, but we think it will be a significant dent in fighting wage theft in the nation. In fact, I just published a book this past fall on wage theft in America, and in it I talk about the vital role that unions play in this and why we got to have the Employee Free Choice Act.
And that book is Lives Matter, A Handbook for Christian Organizing.
That's the first book.
I'm doing this on the fly, Kim.
That's all right. I got it.
The new book is Wage Theft in America, Why Millions of Working Americans Are Not Getting Paid and What We Can Do About It. And this is actually a manual for prosecuting or resisting or it, discovering wage
yeah,
theft?
Let me tell you what the book does. First, it kind of overviews what the problem is, because a lot of people are like you. They're like, really? Employers are out there stealing wages? How does that happen, right?
I mean, I kind of figured they do. I just...
Anyway, so it explains how it happens. Then I talk about why it happens, because there's not the kind of pushback forces that we need in the society. And then I talk about what we can do about it. And the good news about wage theft compared to, frankly, most of the other problems we face as a nation is we know how to solve this one. It's really not that complicated, right?
It is solvable.
We just got to have the will to do it. But we can, you know, it's not like figuring out the banking crisis or getting out of Iraq, right? Those are complicated. This is not complicated.
I love that. I just love that. You are part of this Interfaith Alliance, to what degree does your faith inform your efforts?
I'm here doing this work because of my faith, right? I was actually raised in an evangelical tradition and memorized a lot of Bible verses
as a kid.
I'm a
recovering Southern Baptist myself.
Well, I was raised Church of Christ, so.
Oh, no, the We Don't Sing No Tambourines Church of Christ?
That's exactly
right.
Oh,
my God.
In fact, I can sing great harmony.
I bet you can.
I direct the choir at my own church right now, so.
I grew up working concerts and doing backstage and sound and stuff for all those. I mean, I grew up in Alabama. There would be these huge a cappella sings that would. It was like a fundamentalist Woodstock.
Oh
really,
yeah. I went to them.
I know all about them.
In fact, my mother recently passed, and my sister and I sang hymns. We took the good old Church Christ hymnal, and we just sang from one end to the other.
Right? So you got the good end of it, and you moved away from some of the more bizarre stuff.
If you really study the scriptures, which frankly I memorized a lot as a kid,
sword drills. We had sword drills in
Baptist. I had them. If you went across a little mountain, you'd win the little pink Bible at the end, right? The boys got a blue Bible, but the girls got a pink little pink Bible.
No, you had to stand stock still, ramrod stiff, and you had a hardback King James version because, you know, the devil makes the other versions. And they'd call out the verse, and you had to present your Bible, and you had to button, and you had to turn it, and you had to get to it. And, you had to be able to get through that thing.
Well, we didn't do it quite that same way, but, you know, the same kind of approach terms of memory. But, you know, something stuck in my spirit, right? Yeah. And frankly,
like if you've done it under the least of these, you've also done it also
under
me.
Yeah, something like that.
That one stuck. See, I'm recovering, but that one stayed.
It's a little hard to imagine how you're going to get to heaven if you don't take care of poor people, right? I mean, that's what the Scripture says, Matthew 25, right? And again, the heart of the gospel, you know, people ask Jesus, you know, what's the first commandment? Love God. What's the second commandment? Love your neighbor as yourself. Well, okay. Again, that's pretty basic,
unequivocal,
right? You know, and frankly, thou shalt not steal as a commandment is, I think it applies to wages. What do you think?
It doesn't say thou shalt not steal from somebody who's better than you.
That's right. Or it doesn't say thou shalt not steal, except it doesn't include wages, right? It includes it, obviously.
Well, and of course, you know, there's even the parable that touches upon wages that has it's got a lot to do with more to do with the hereafter. But you know, there's the issue that you get the benefit of your bargain, whether you sign on for the shekel at 5 o'clock or the
shekel
at 8 a.m.
That's right. I mean,
I
think that parable is really talking about that people need a living wage.
Yes,
right.
It is.
I
think you're absolutely
and
right.
Some of us can work, you know, all full hours, and some folks can't quite work it. And frankly, some people still need a living wage regardless.
And yet, if we talk, if we do something as heretical as saying living wage in the United States, there is an entire right wing machine that is ready to scream communist in our faces and socialist.
Well, you know what? We just gotta say, so what? You know, come on. Yeah, on this living wage one, the religious community has actually been very good. You know, every single living wage campaign in the country, the religious community is all over, right? Because people get it, right, that you need living wages to make it. So, you know, I think we just got to, you know, let them call us what they will, right? We just got to stand
and
up for what's
right.
And just
keep moving.
And keep moving, absolutely.
They call Dr. King a commie,
absolutely.
Too.
That's, you know, every person who's done well has been called a communist.
So in terms of wage theft, you know, usually people who have been coming by here and sitting down at the table say, well, you know, we got this bill out there, and then we want this bill passed and call your congressman. What do you want people to do?
I do want people to call their congressperson in support of the Employee Free Choice Act. Having more unions would certainly make a difference. Secondly, you should go to Can My Boss Do That,
which
is a new website, canmybossdothat.com. Which, if you want to understand whether you're being paid fairly, it can help you understand that. Thirdly, we have chapters around the country that are working closely with workers who haven't gotten paid. We're doing prayer vigils outside employers' homes.
Cool.
We're doing little prayer vigils at their place of business. And frankly, you know what? We get people's wages back that way. It's very effective.
Yeah, because it's really hard to say, go beat up those praying people and get them out.
In fact, I got an email this past Friday from a colleague in Memphis, and she'd taken a prayer group to the Happy Mexican restaurant. That's what it was called, the Happy Mexican.
Yep.
Well, the Happy Mexican didn't make happy workers because they hadn't paid them. So they get up, they go show up at the restaurant, they start praying for the wages to get paid. First, the manager comes out and curses at them. 15 minutes later, he came back out, paid them all. Paid them.
Oh,
15
just,
minutes of prayer.
Oh, that makes me proud. That makes me proud. That's amazing. So canmybossdothat.com.
.com, and then IWJ.org, interfaithworkerjustice.org as well, to find more resources and how you can get involved.
Okay. Kim, this is enlightening, and it's also inspiring. I'm so glad they scheduled you, because you didn't know me from Adam's house, Kat, but you were willing to get the message out, and I hope you know that you have a friend and ally in the horn.
Great. Thanks so much.
Wonderful. And best of luck with your message with other folks.
All right. And find there are some progressive Baptist churches. You just got to find one.
At this point, I've decided I'm a Frisbeterian.
Oh, well, all right.
We believe when you die, your soul goes up on the roof and you can't get it down.
Well, there you go. God bless anyway.
Exactly. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And best of luck.
And, you know, it's blessings for what you're doing. And fair day's wage for fair day's work.
Absolutely.
Thank you very kindly.
Thanks,
take
Bob.
Care. Maybe shoot us an MP3 of some of that acapella work. Kim Bobo, founder of Interfaith Worker Justice, canmybossdothat.com, and interfaithworkerjustice.org. Is that, or interfaithworkerjustice.org. Okay. By the way, she wasn't kidding about the singing. She really is the choir director at her Good News Community Church. It's a multicultural congregation in the Rogers Park neighborhood of Chicago. You know, I think I could go in there and enjoy a Sunday morning. I really think I could. Go and have a look. And, you know, if you work for a living and you make an hourly wage and you wonder if you're getting stiffed, shafted, screwed, go check out the website, canmybossdothat.com. Cool, cool, cool. So it is about, we are right at the top of the hour. We are at coming up on 2 p.m. Guy James was just multitasking with the camera there. Did I break it, the camera?
No, but you got that light right behind you, and I'm having trouble getting a really great picture.
I think it would be a really great picture with the whole George Bush halo effect behind me. Remember the George Bush halo?
You have that, yes. Yeah, you do have that.
And it's as close as I'll
this
ever come to
comes natural
having,
for you.
Yeah, exactly. Are
you doing news at the top of the hour?
I don't know that there's necessarily any news to do. Mainly, it's been so busy, and I've been running so tragically behind that I've just been shooting through from one conversation to the next.
I always give them a schedule of news at the top of the hour. So
I hate to say this, but this almost feels a little bit like work, Guy.
Yes, it is. It is work. We shall have to relax and
commiserate.
Yes, there's Mr. Bob Borisaj, who's the head of Campaign for America's Future. I think we're talking to him a little bit later on today.
You've got him. I've got Eric Bollert here in a few minutes. I've got Jim Dean coming.
Kim was interesting, wasn't she?
Wasn't she just like a big old cold glass of water?
Yeah. Yeah. So many times.
And that's what you see with this whole event, guys. So many different people committed to so many different aspects, all of which point in the same direction, and that is making people's lives better. Because when we make people's lives better at the end of the day, that's where you wind up with America's future.
That's right. That's all this whole conference is about every year. We're here with all kinds of stripes and issues. See a good many of our friends from Radio Row that we see every year here. John Elliott down there. Do you know John?
I saw John a little bit ago.
Yeah, he's just sitting down there. And LaVisa always does a wonderful job of helping setting these things up.
Oh, she's just been wonderful. And everybody here just dedicated to getting the job done. Do you know what is the history? How long has this happened, been going on?
I think this is the sixth year. I could be wrong in that, but I think it's the sixth conference.
Well, it seems that they've got it down to pretty much a formula. It's down to a science.
It is. Run them in and run them out. We want to get as many interviews in as possible. That's their goal. And you found that out already, that it definitely is a lot like work.
You'd almost say it beats working, but it's fairly close. I'll tell you what, you had a great idea there, and I think I'm going to take you up on it. We're going to take a brief break and go and check out some labor radio news. You are listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to Activist Radio. You're listening to The Horn, and we'll be back.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Senior Obama administration officials said Sunday night that GM will file for bankruptcy Monday, For workers, GM's bankruptcy filing will throw decades of building a blue-collar middle class into reverse. The real issue for workers is not whether a much smaller, restructured GM can emerge from bankruptcy to be a viable new company. The real question is, where will workers stand in this restructured auto world? Obama administration officials say the qualified pension plans for both hourly and salaried workers will be carried over to the new GM and remain intact, and benefits will be paid as normal. UAW President Ron Gettelfinger says 20 to 25% of UAW workers' benefits were given back in the latest round of concessions, a $1.3 billion per year loss for auto workers. The right to strike is gone for 6 years, and wages are frozen for 6 years. But Gettelfinger insists the UAW still has power and is ready for whatever GM does.
The mediation, in the event that we couldn't reach an agreement, I do not see that as deluding us. There are other provisions in the agreement that we have a right to strike over, and we're prepared for whatever eventually happens here.
GM was once responsible for $80 billion earned by workers to pay for their retiree health care. The UAW agreed to form the VEBA Trust Fund and take over that obligation, cutting GM's cost to $57 billion. That was slashed to $20 billion. Sunday night, a senior Obama administration official said the VEBA will now get just a $2.5 billion note, $6.5 billion in preferred stock, 17.5% of GM common stock, and warrants to buy another 2.5%. And U.S. workers will suffer even if a smaller GM survives. GM can import more cars to sell under the GM nameplate in the U.S., and a lower two-tier wage system for new hires pays them half the current going rate. From its peak of nearly 1.5 million members in 1979, the UAW is down now to roughly 400,000. The collapse of the U.S. auto industry into the United Auto Workers Union's power is a terrible blow to future generations of U.S. workers who will no longer have that path to the blue-collar middle class. Current and former workers at plants in two states that produced uranium during the Cold War have received more than $1.5 billion in compensation and medical benefits from the U.S. Labor Department. Jesse Russell has more.
9,134 workers at facilities in Tennessee will share more than $1 billion for their work and exposure at a Y-12 nuclear weapons plant, the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and a K-25 uranium enrichment plant. An additional $500 million will be shared by 4,798 workers at a diffusion plant in Kentucky. The payments will be provided to workers that have been diagnosed with cancer and other illnesses that can be caused by exposure to radiation.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yeah, okay, so it's not exactly night, and it's not tonight's final hour by any stretch of the imagination. Just a reminder, coming up as we continue the live broadcast from the Campaign for America's Future, Progressive Media Row, Secure Our Future, Secure America's Future, being the theme. We've got, after this hour, three more complete hours of live conversation radio. Guy James is making notes and hard at work, preparing for his 2 hours of broadcast quality. Mark Levine will be by here long about 5 o'clock-ish Eastern time. So that's what's in the offing. At present, we are awaiting, I hope, a person you have heard from in the past. Eric Bullard will be joining us, we hope. You've heard him on the show in other circumstances, just more, you know, telephone-oriented interviews. Former professional broadcaster, you know. Contributing editor to Rolling Stone, former senior writer for Salon, senior fellow at Media Matters for America. He is a force to be reckoned with, and Hopefully he will be here presently. Sorry, I'm multitasking here. We're waiting to see what happens and when and how. In the meantime, all kidding aside, you know, I'm not used to working the day shift, so to speak. But I hope at some point in time, and being limited and not able to take your calls, I'm one of the things that's really on my mind is I want your thoughts regarding the slaughter of Dr. Tiller. As I said, I turned on the news this morning, and what I got was stories of the GM bankruptcy, stories of the missing French airplane, and somewhere down around, you know, minute 37 of the broadcast hour, oh yeah, America is shocked because a right-wing murderer killed a doctor in Kansas. It is disturbing in the extreme. 2 summers in a row. I'm not kidding. 2 summers in a row. They are literally killing us in churches. Please tell me how that differs from the Taliban. Tell me how much difference there is between a fundamentalist murderer in Kansas and a fundamentalist murderer in Kandahar. I can't see that there is much. And, of course, this is another instance where, and this is 2 summers in a row, by the way, 2 summers in a row where the handprints of Bill O'Reilly are there to be seen in broad daylight. You'll recall that Mr. Adkisson, who tried to murder all the liberals in that church in Knoxville, them Unitarians. Remember him? Yeah, he had Bill O'Reilly books on his shelf, and he had learned the vocabulary of hate directly from Bill O'Reilly. Well, that connection exists here recently as well. Because, after all, Bill O'Reilly referred to Dr. Tiller as Killer the Killer. Have a seat. Oh, thank you. Eric Bollert is with us. You may not recall, because I'm sure you talk to everybody and their cousin, but I'm Bob Kincaid. We've talked before via the phone. Excuse me. I'm really excited to have a chance to talk with you today, Eric, just because I love the work that you do at Media
Matters. Oh, thanks.
Matters. We're talking a little bit today about bloggers on the bus and how the internet changed politics and the press. But because you at Media Matters do such a magnificent job of following media trends, something that I was just talking about at the top of the hour,
yeah,
here, if you don't mind my
not
taking a moment from you. What I just told the audience, we're live. This is the second summer in a row that people deem to be liberal or not sufficiently American have been slaughtered in their church, Eric.
Yeah.
You know, last year it was Tennessee Valley Unitarian, yep, Universalist Fellowship. Yesterday it's Dr. Tiller in Kansas. Both of them, there's a common thread to both of them, because they both killers were apparently or possibly motivated by Bill O'Reilly. What more is being done to document this sort of thing? I saw where the FBI in the news story about yesterday's killing said, well, we will be learning every angle about,
right,
it. And the first thing that came to mind, Eric, was, are they going to mention the fact that these people were right-wing Republicans?
That's right, and it'll be interesting to see if the press, I haven't seen any mention of Bill O'Reilly in the press, in the sort of the very first updates. And I think it would be important to mention that he talked about Dr. Tiller, I think, 28 times on the air.
Tiller the Killer.
Tiller the Killer.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. A couple months ago, we had the cop killing in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Where Richard Poplawski was sort of this right-wing nut. And his friends told the press that he was afraid Obama was going to come and take his guns, so he basically set up an ambush for the Pittsburgh cops. Mm-hmm. And when they showed up at his porch, he shot them with a high-powered rifle and killed them. And he was a big Glenn Beck fan.
Yes.
He used to post his links. Glenn Beck would tell people that Obama was coming to take your guns. And now we have the Dr. Killer situation, Tiller situation, where you've got O'Reilly calling him, you know, Tiller the Killer. This is what Fox News does now. I mean, they sort of peddle this hate rhetoric. After the Poplawski and the Pittsburgh situation, it struck me as sort of an embrace of the militia media, the militia movement during the 90s.
Well, you know, if you try to call them on any of this, Eric, what you hear from them immediately, well, that's not fair. You know, those are just random, insane people.
Right.
At what point in time, or perhaps how, do we take that defense away from them?
Well, it's, you know, I think the press plays a big part. I mean, just think if the roles were reversed. I mean, think if some sort of left-wing nut, you know, who was Rachel Maddow fan, went into an evangelical church like last summer in Tennessee and just started shooting people, and then they went back to the killer's house and they found all my books and lots of other liberal books, mm-hmm. and a manifesto written by the killer saying how he had to wipe conservatives off the face of the earth. We'd still be talking about that story.
Yes,
literally
a year later.
But for some reason, you know, right-wing radicals aren't radical, and they're not dangerous in terms of the eyes of the press. It's only that creeping, unseen liberal radicals, which we can never really uncover.
Acorn.
They're the real danger. So, I don't know. You know, we've seen a lot of this stuff, and it just goes back. I mean, you know, the mainstream press won't really call out Fox News for what it is. I mean, they push this hate rhetoric, and really, they've essentially turned themselves into the opposition party for the Obama
right.
White House, which is just an extraordinary thing for any quote-unquote journalism.
I can't recall any.
We've never seen anything like it.
Even with their hunting of Bill Clinton, it was not at this degree, this
depth. No, that's right. That's a good point. People don't forget. I mean, when Fox News went on the air in the late 90s, it was sort of legit. I think the Florida recount was a turning point where they mm-hmm. really sort of stepped back from any sort of impartiality. And then, of course, the Iraq War was it
right,
changed
but
everything.
That,
but then you think, okay, it can't get any worse. And then with the Obama inauguration.
Every time it does.
And then with the Obama inauguration, it really, they just went to another level. They brought in Glenn Beck. They started calling Obama, you know, a Marxist and a socialist, and he's going to take your gun. And, yeah, we're going to have people get killed because of it. I don't think there's any question.
Is there any way to frame all of this any differently? I mean, I know you guys think about this
yeah.
all the time. Maybe I don't even know what I'm asking, Eric. But is there something more we can do? Is there more noise to be made, or at some point does someone personally call out O'Reilly or a Savage or a Beck?
Right.
Because apparently some of it is getting through. Because after the Poplawski issue incident, I did hear them, Beck and it was, I think it was a clip that was provided by Media Matters. I heard Beck and O'Reilly opining back and forth about why it wasn't their fault.
Right. Oh, it definitely struck a chord. I noticed a change with Beck and Fox in the week or two after that, particularly the gun, you know, the gun rhetoric and stuff. It's frustrating. I know the feeling. You feel like you're just hitting your head against the wall against this stuff. But the problem is that it's hard to break through on the cable talk shows, and they just won't frame it the right way. But you just sort of have to keep pushing and keep pushing and keep pushing. And it's tragic to see people, these conservatives continue to go to churches to kill people. I mean, it's just astounding. It's hard to even put into words. But
it makes you feel like you got marbles in your head, doesn't it?
And the press just does not really want to connect dots. It's very dangerous territory to go, and they think it's dangerous, and so they're just not they're not willing to do it.
Well, I think, watch the smooth transition here. I think part of the fact of what you've discussed here, the failures of the mainstream media, the for-profit media, whatever we want to call them,
has been
one of the driving impulses behind the creation of a very potent liberal blogosphere, which is, after all, the topic of your book.
That's right.
Bloggers on the Bus: How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. How long has it been in the making? How long did you research it? What did you do?
Oh, I've 2 years, but really the last, really all of 2008. And what I wanted to do with the book is sort of provide some context and history to the liberal blogosphere. They're still portrayed as mostly faceless players by the mainstream press, which does not want to give them all that much credit, I think.
But there's real journalism. I mean,
there's real journalism, and there are fascinating stories behind the people. These are people, you know, housewives and attorneys and musicians and movie producers, people who had no connection to politics or the press at all. But really, people who suffered they suffered through impeachment, they suffered through the Florida recount, they're watching the run-up to the war, and they just got tired of throwing stuff at the TV. And so they looked at their PC and their laptop, and they said, well, I'll try to keep sane, because I'll post some stuff online. And then it really gained momentum, and they were right about the war, and they were right about the Bush administration, and they were right about everything that the press went right about. And so they gained this real momentum and became sort of the silver lining in the whole media landscape. So I wanted to put that in perspective, and I also wanted to tell some of these very interesting life stories of the people behind it. So I traveled around the country and interviewed a lot of people, and then I also used the 2008 campaign as sort of the backdrop to show how they did, you know, have a very direct effect both in the campaign and in our press.
I guess in the liberal blogosphere, I go so far back, I remember when it was Left Blog Sylvania. But just out of curiosity, one of the guys who has been at this almost longer than anyone else, did you happen to get a chance to talk to Bartkop? Are you familiar with
him? Yeah, I'm familiar, but didn't get a talk to Bartkop. I think it was, I interviewed Duncan Black, who blogs as Atrios at Eschaton. I think one of his first hangout spots was Bartkop. Digby at Hullabaloo also talked a lot about Bartkop. Very influential. There was the Salon Table Talk sort of in the late 90s, Bartkop was another one of the very first places that people realized there were other people that felt like them. It was that simple. But, you know, back during impeachment, there weren't many places. You certainly couldn't get that perspective from watching cable news.
No.
And Bartkop was a spot where people realized, oh, my God, I am not alone. And it's, again, it sounds so simple, but it was a revelation, really, for an entire generation of people.
When you, is it still growing? I've seen people say that, you know, the blogging phenomenon has plateaued, or, did you see that, or are you still seeing a lot more creative energy poured into it?
Oh, I think there's a lot of creative energy, but I also think you have to acknowledge that, you know, it was built around, had this luxury, this sort of ironic luxury of having the Bush administration to rally around in a war, to rally around, and it's hard to replace that if you're building a movement. I mean, it's very easy to get people passionate about both those things. So I think it's almost inevitable that it's going to have to plateau with the Obama administration in the White House. Now, will a new sort of movement spring up, or will the momentum that started during the Bush years simply create, you know, sort of catch a new generation and it'll keep growing? That's very possible. I don't think it has permanently peaked. But, yeah, if your whole movement is built around the war, it's built around Bush, once Bush leaves the stage, it's going to have to become something else and something new. And that's what we're seeing on an almost weekly basis.
What you just described, you know, the war, George Bush, if you take away someone's raison d'etre, you know, there's no there left. But, as you mentioned that, the 2008 election cycle was the backdrop to what you were doing.
Yeah.
In the info I've got here, it says, you know, on the net roots. I assume that you have confined yourself to the liberal or progressive side of this.
I did do a chapter on the conservative bloggers just to point out what I felt.
Both of them?
What I felt is just sort of this light years in difference. And I highlighted sort of one of the endless sort of loopy conspiracy theories that they engaged in during the campaign about Obama. And that really did define the conservative blogosphere during the campaign, just sort of these nonstop sort of half-baked identity-based conspiracy. I mean,
Muslim doesn't have a birth certificate.
Exactly. People are still looking for the birth certificate. And these are really were the, sort of the best and brightest of what the conservatives had to offer. And it's been, you know, after the McCain loss, we saw a lot of articles in the press about, you know, now conservatives were had learned their lesson and they were going to sort of jumpstart this thing. And it's amazing. I mean, you would think we'd see those articles in 2004, 2005. I mean, the blogosphere essentially defined the decade in politics, and conservatives are still trying to figure it out. I mean, it really is sort of this epic failure.
Yeah, the Republicans are still. Yeah, the liberals are taking the internet forward, and the liberals are still, or the conservatives are still trying to figure out how to make the clock quit blinking on their VCRs.
It's really they are wed to the AM talk radio. It worked. It's worked for decades. John McCain thought it was going to work again. It didn't work because they really didn't have a McCain didn't really have a hate message that AM talk radio could
well,
really
didn't
rally
even
around
like him.
Exactly. But they're wed to this AM right wing radio. And Democrats have this amazing thing online in terms of the bloggers here.
That's why the horn is online and it's not.
That's right.
You will never turn your car on and hear us on a terrestrial
radio.
Well,
look,
station.
I mean, 90% of talk radio in this country is right wing, according to the 2007 study. And you know, they don't raise a dime for candidates. They don't care who gets elected. They can't point to a single member of Congress and say we got that person elected.
Right.
But bloggers can, and they do, and they're very much more active politically. So, going forward, Democrats and progressives have this really still, I think, untapped sort of power resource in the blogosphere, and Republicans still think AM radio. I mean, Clear Channel is going to be bankrupt in 2 years. It's not going to exist.
Well, if that long, sure.
So their future is not particularly bright with their AM radio model in it.
Well, that's where I was leading, Eric. One of the things about the right wing is that they do lockstep
really
well.
It's very interesting. And a quick point about that. I mean, liberals don't do lockstep, and even liberal bloggers, and I'm guilty on this, and it's just as much as someone else. I'll start writing a blog post or a column or something, and then I realize halfway through someone had already written it, and so the liberal journalist or the liberal blogger reaction is to stop and throw it away.
Right.
And because no one wants to repeat some, even if it's like by 8 minutes, well, someone else already said it. Why would I say it again? And the right wing, that's what they live for. I mean, not only is it not a sign of weakness, it's really why they exist. So it's a very interesting point. It's something about the DNA and that, you know, liberals are starting to learn that that an echo chamber is not always an insult, and that you know, repetition is a good thing, and that's how you affect the larger conversation.
Well, and also within that context, Eric, and with the backdrop of the 2008 election, what kind of willingness do you see? I remember when Dr. Dean said, "I come from the Democratic Democratic Party."
Right.
Do you see a willingness to push back against the Obama administration?
Yeah. Yeah, we've already seen it. We saw it with the torture photos when the White House did a pretty abrupt about-face. We've seen it in terms of the Obama administration continuing the wiretapping policies of the Bush administration. We've seen pretty robust criticism in terms of Afghanistan policy. So, yeah, I think a lot of the mainstream media critics were saying, well, you know, the bloggers are just going to roll over. They're just cheerleaders for Obama. They're not really serious people. But I think we've seen more criticism of the Obama White House in 4 months than conservative bloggers gave the Bush administration in 8 years.
Oh, without a doubt. So let me ask you, I guess, maybe the final question. Why is it then, you've identified a phenomenon that we're all familiar with, we understand the viability of it, we understand the importance of it, you know, this has all in the world to do with the importance of it, what
conference.
We're doing today. Why then, this is one of those pushback moments, why then does President Obama sit down to a hearty meal of hummingbird tongue canapes with right-wing gas bags
Right.
And the liberal blogosphere gets Kool-Aid and cookies.
Yeah, I think.
I mean, that really happened.
Yeah, I think the next day he met. I don't think he's ever met with any bloggers. I think the next day that he met with some liberal columnist, E.J. Dionne, et cetera. But certainly the one that got the headlines was, well, he went to Charles Krauthammer's house, or and so
sat down, broke bread with Bill Kristol,
right? And who now all hate him, and we all knew he would. You know, I think it was an attempt to sort of, you know, change the dialogue a little bit. Bloggers were very unhappy, and they thought it was ridiculous, and it was only legitimizing. And they claimed that the writers weren't going to change what they said, and they proved to be true. I'm not even sure the White House thought that they were going to change their minds. But I think they wanted to sort of lay down a marker in more of a political way. But, you know, it's interesting. You know, during the campaign, you know, people always, their conventional wisdom, you know, Obama was the internet candidate. And,
right.
But he certainly won over the internet. He did not engage with the blogs in any serious extended way. And he told reporters he didn't read blogs. So there was definite attention. You know, he was much more of a centrist candidate than they would have, it gets complicated, that they would have liked. I say that, but then most of them supported him. So there was also something going on within the blogosphere in that they supported a candidate who never really made any promise to be a liberal candidate or to be a liberal president.
No, I think a lot of us superimposed our hopes onto him. Because
I think that happened, yes.
He wasn't John McCain. We were going to have relief from George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a lot of, you know, well, maybe we can do that FDR thing where, you know, we make him do it.
Right, but I think they are holding him accountable, but I think a lot of bloggers thought, you know, last November, you know, we can go over this finish line together in this warm embrace, and the Obama campaign will embrace the infrastructure we've already created. They essentially built their own. They had enough money. They built their own. It was called MyBarackObama.com. It was a Facebook application. It was a phenomenon like we've never seen.
Well, just watch the fun and games they've had with, for instance, Don't Ask, Don't Tell on the White House webpage in the last couple of months. Where, you know, it went from, you know, this will end to,
right,
gosh,
this is important, and the good news, I think, in terms of a movement is, if you go back to the Clinton years, when the Clintons triangulated and moved to the center because they felt they had to, there was no organized pushback. There was no coalesced voice. There was no clarion call from any liberal movement, mm-hmm, saying, yes, I mean, there was a couple scattered voices. But the Clinton administration and the Democrats did that without impunity because they knew they weren't going to pay a price because there was no liberal base to the movement, because the laborers were sort of in, labor unions were in decline. And now, you know, when Democrats in the White House move to the center, they're still going to do it, but I think the dynamic has changed that there's going to be an organized pushback, and they know that, and it's part of their calculation, and at least from a liberal perspective, a liberal movement perspective, it's a start. They're at the table, their voice is there, and then the next step is getting the implementation.
Is healthcare the next big test of the validity of the liberal blogosphere?
Well, probably, sure. I mean, absolutely. It's always been a priority. They're absolutely behind it. They don't want to sort of a Band-Aid approach. They want a radical transformation of healthcare in America, particularly for the working class. And, if for some reason the Obama White House, we haven't seen any indication of that, but completely punts on health care and doesn't take into account any of the liberal initiatives, that would definitely be an insult and a setback. But we haven't seen any indication of that. But there's no question that's the number one priority, and that's something that they're working all the time to try to implement.
Well, Eric Bullard, thank you very much.
I've
enjoyed every conversation we have ever had. The new book is Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. Eric Bullard, senior fellow at Media Matters. I wish you the very best, and available at Amazon, Powell's, all the usual fun spots.
Absolutely.
All right. Is it available at Media Matters?
You can get an autographed copy there as part of a donation to Media Matters as well.
Well, you know what? I think that would be more than appropriate.
That would be.
It's a pleasure to finally meet you in person, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
All right.
We are at about 27 minutes before the hour. This three-hour segment of me working during the daytime has absolutely flown by. I am flummoxed and flabbergasted by the whole affair. And standing by and ready to rock, none other than Jim Dean of Democracy for America. Jump right up and have a seat. I'm so pleased to meet you in person, sir. We are
Bob, thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's a joy. It's a joy and a pleasure. You know, we've talked on the phone in the past,
yes,
and everything.
Yep.
But never sat and worked face to face. So this is my first trip to this Progressive Media Row, and it's been quite an exciting experience. You, of course, are at front and center of all the efforts of Democracy for America, an organization of which I've always been fond and have recently gotten fonder, seeing as how you guys have a hand in me going to Netroots Nation now.
Oh, good. That's great.
I'm one of the scholars.
Oh, terrific. Okay.
And it's really exciting. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're looking forward to doing a little bit of what we're doing here. We're going to take the entire Netroots Nation event, mm-hmm, every minute, every second, every session, every breakout, every panel is going out live for people worldwide who can't be there. So we're going to try to expand that progressive message a little bit.
That is
green
awesome.
It up a little, yep, bit, and I'm really excited.
Good.
Of course, part and you know the biggest thing that I'm seeing coming out of DFA right now is the healthcare,
yep,
issue, and that couldn't be more fitting in light of your brother's commitment to,
mm-hmm,
it. Let me just start and start out by asking Jim, why is the single payer or the universal,
yeah,
issue? Why is it all crickets? Where Max Baucus? You know that
yeah,
whole foo frah. Why can't we even talk about it? It's like some sort of heresy, isn't it?
No, we can talk about it all the time.
I mean, and I talk about it,
yeah,
sure.
I mean, but, you know, listen, a lot of our members are advocates for single payer.
Right.
And we're not suggesting, by the way, that they not work on single payer. I don't believe that these are mutually exclusive goals. And I think there's lots of people that support H.R. 676, Representative Conyers' bill.
Medicare for all.
Yes, exactly. And frankly, if I had a choice in this thing, I would like that also. But here's the reason why we got into the support for a public option. First of all, it's the president's plan, and because of that, and really only because of that, it's going to get a full legislative hearing. And we really believe very strongly that nobody, whether you're a single payer advocate or not, nobody should sit out this debate. And we can already see the stuff that's coming out of the Senate, that these people really need a reality check. And so if you're out there we really need to be calling, and we need to be pressuring the Senate to come up with a credible public option. The other part about this is that a platform of a real and credible public option, I think, will give single-payer advocates the far better basis to further that campaign. So I don't think we should lose sight of that. And, you know, again, I don't consider it necessarily an either-or proposition. I think both probably work in the same direction,
mm-hmm,
but because, again, this public option is the president's plan and it's going to go through the legislative process, we've got to be there.
Right,
and I
right.
do think it was a mistake, and frankly, it wasn't helped by some voices out of the Senate to say that this was off the table. I think that was, frankly, a little bit silly. I think those folks, you know, we should have included everybody.
Well, I'll be a little bit radical here. I'm tired of my elected representatives telling me what's off the table and what's
exactly.
not.
Exactly.
Because, you know, we look at the torture scandal. It's not a scandal. It's a horror, Jim.
Yep.
The horror of Americans engaging in torture.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but be a little bit bitter and think, you know, maybe we wouldn't have been dealing with this the way it was if we hadn't been told that impeachment was off the table. You know, if you tell burglars that you're going to stop prosecuting burglars, burglary doesn't go down, it goes up.
Right.
And so I'm a little frustrated with liberals and progressives being told what is and isn't on
right.
the table. And so I'm.
Well, that's true. And the one thing, again, about the reason that we don't want to sit out this public option debate is because it will give people the choice. And I think, frankly, when consumers get the choice in this thing, you're going to see some very interesting thing happen in healthcare. First of all, the most underinsured group in this country are people under the age of 32 or 35.
Yes, absolutely.
this isn't a situation where the government's going to end up covering all the people that are sick and all the healthy people are going to be in private health plans. These folks don't have insurance, and they're going to be very, very interested in what the government has to offer. And then you have entities like, well, Democracy for America, who provides health care coverage for 14 employees. I'm not looking for a better deal, Bob. I'm just looking for a more reliable provider.
Exactly.
I would gladly pay the same premium to somebody else, the government, perhaps, if they're going to offer me comparable coverage.
Sure.
I'm not looking for save money. I'm not looking for anything off the taxpayers. I want our employees to be enrolled in a more reliable program, and that's what we've got to fight for now, to make sure that that option is on the table. And once we've got that, once that bill is in law, once we have that apparatus getting set up, then that's a living regulatory environment that can be expanded
if that's
what consumers want,
exactly.
If that's what the American people want.
I guess, Jim, I'm just a little bit mean. Because I look at it this way. I don't want to take away anybody's for-profit health care coverage. I don't want to force anybody into anything. If people want to continue health care coverage with some company that pays somebody a Christmas bonus based on how many liver transplants they deny,
yeah,
I want them to have that miserable coverage.
Yeah,
but I want a public option out there.
Yep.
So that because these are things more than nuts and bolts and dollars and pennies. These are moral issues, frankly, because I kind of draw a line at some point. At what point did we get this notion that someone's fear and apprehension and sickness and illness and agony and misery and death were a proper venue for the profit motive?
I think it dates back to World War II when we had wage and price controls, and employers started offering health care as a way to entice workers who were actually, most of whom were going into the military to fight in World War II.
Right.
It's very interesting. On the other hand, Europe started their health care program out of nothing. They had no health care system.
And that's what President Obama referred to the other day.
Here's the bottom line on this. When I was growing up as a kid, Bob, we were like number two or number one in life expectancy. We
sure.
were like one of the highest ranking countries in infant mortality rates. We were one of the highest ranking countries, and I mean in a good way, in almost every other healthcare measure. We're not anymore. We're somewhere around 28th in life expectancy. We're somewhere around 10th or 11th in infant mortality. By a whole bunch of other measures, we're around 17. The countries that are ahead of, there are a lot of countries that are ahead of us on this, but we're paying twice as much money, at least three times as much money in some cases.
For half the care.
No business would allow themselves to operate that way. Why should the American consumer and the American taxpayer put up with the same thing?
Exactly. And you know, do you shame the American people into this? I don't know.
Well, I think there's that fear thing, and Howard mentioned this earlier at a press conference where he was just at. There is the fear factor that the health plans so successfully leveraged during the Clinton era, the Harry and Louise ads or whatever.
Thing that aired yesterday. I don't know if you're.
The Rick Scott thing.
Yeah. Oh my.
It's a great country.
This is brought to you by the same people who did the Swift boat for.
It's even better than that. It's brought to you by a guy who started a health hospital corporation. That whose one of the principal sources of income was the American taxpayer off of Medicare. Was
company
ousted.
Got busted for $1.7 billion in Medicare fraud.
Largest fine ever, ever in a hospital, and now the guy's out making movies about the sanctity of private health care. I mean, Joe Stalin couldn't have had a better guy on his staff.
No,
you know, Nikita Khrushchev couldn't even do this guy's laundry.
So he's, I mean,
we're up against that kind of stuff, and that kind of fear is what we've got to be careful about, and we've got to be having those conversations with our friends and family. We say this all the time.
We're about to be Harry and Louise again, aren't we?
Yep. I mean. But this is the same as a regular campaign, and we got to go out and do stuff about it. It's not, you know, this isn't going to happen because of me or anybody else. It's going to happen because we go out there and really corral the senators, particularly the senators, and get them to understand what the reality of this is, not the reality they're living in, which isn't very real, but, the federal health care. But, we need them to understand what American people are really going through.
Well, what is the heart and soul of, and I've seen it at the DFA website.
Yeah.
What is the heart and soul of Stand With Dr. Dean?
The heart and soul is to not sit out this debate. I mean, we have a petition drive. We're up around 360,000 signatures. We got all these letters, the editor coming in. We're right in the middle of doing tutorials so that we can start arranging for meetings with congressional leaders and their staff. All of these things are important, but it's critically important that all of us, no matter whether it's through Staying With Dr. Dean or some other vehicle, be involved in this healthcare debate and have their voices heard. That's the most critical essence of it. And, we have some tools up there that may make this a little bit more user-friendly and easier to do. So I encourage you to take a look at that, standwithdrdean.com. But there may be other ways to do it, too. We're not saying we're the only way to do it, but there's lots of other ways to get involved. But the most important thing is to get involved.
Well, I got to thinking, based on what Dr. Dean has said and the nature of his advocacy, and I've watched the economic collapse, Jim, for the last year.
Yeah.
And I thought, my God, we can't even trust Wall Street with our money. Why in God's name do we trust them with our lives?
Yeah.
Because, isn't that where we are right now?
It is. A health system largely dominated by private sector where we've declined. And we are behind a lot of countries that we all like to think we're ahead of, but we're not. We're not ahead of France. We're way behind. France has a far better healthcare system.
We've got maternal mortality. Yeah. We've got maternal death co-equal with Iran and lower than Cuba.
Yep. Bob, you got Rick Scott out there telling everybody how bad it is in England and Canada. Let me tell you something. Those countries are doing better. You want to live longer? Be a resident of England and Canada. All those same examples that Rick Scott tried to use on that video, which was so misleading yesterday, are being used about countries that are frankly doing better than we are, and we can do better than this.
How do you counter Rick Scott?
Well, sure, you could go on the media and do air wars, but I think the biggest thing again is you got to reach out and run it like an election campaign and talk to your family, friends, and neighbors, and call your folks in Congress, particularly in the Senate. Especially in the Senate, they really need to hear from us. They will not know unless we tell them over, over, and over again. So,
does DFA have a list of who we know to be allies and
yes.
who we know, friends and foes, as it were?
Yep, it's on the Staying With Dr. Dean website, which is part of Democracy for America, democracyforamerica.com. If you go there, you'll find it all. And there is a list of folks in Congress, and even those folks who are supporting public option or even single payer, they need to know that we support them in this, too.
Yes.
This is not just a, hey, vote this way or else. This is, we've got your back. A lot of folks have really stood up on this, and they need to know it. And for the folks that are still making a decision, they need your help to do it.
Absolutely.
This is not going to happen because, somebody comes up with another movie saying how great health, a public option would be. It's only going to happen if we get involved and take matters into our own hands.
Absolutely. I guess we've spent most of the time talking about health care because I've seen that be so prominently featured at the DFA website. But your organization has done so much to bring the progressive or I'm one of those weirdos who calls myself a liberal.
Yeah.
To bring the liberal community together. Healthcare is the front and center, but I don't want you to leave the table without being able to bring forward anything else that really matters right now.
Yep.
What else is DFA working on?
Well, we're actually still doing what we normally do, which is try to help people take responsibility over the political process. We have a training program that we're doing every weekend. I understand you're from Alabama, by the way.
Well, I was born and raised in Alabama, but I'm from I live in West Virginia now.
We'll be down in Alabama anyway this year.
My goodness. Wow.
We're in out in Riverside, California, and then going to Redding. We're basically out training every single weekend for the rest of the
year.
That's
a beautiful thing.
And those are great ways to come together with a lot of like-minded folks. But more importantly, it's if you're someone who's got a job trying to take care of people you love, it's hard to devote 2 hours a week to making democracy better.
Right.
These training programs are a good way to find out how to make your time and your interest in democracy this as effective as it can possibly be. And So there's a lot you can find out again also about this on the website. We've got about 800 groups around the country, and we're going to be supporting a lot of candidates running for local office, which I'm really really glad to be back at now, now that the presidential race is
right,
over.
Right, teaching people how to be candidates, in other words.
A lot of great people who want to just do stuff to make their communities better.
Let me ask you before you go, what is the status of the 50-state strategy? Because when you know, that was reminded when you said, oh, we're going to be in Alabama. Good. Thank God you're going to be in Alabama.
We had a training there the last time, and as you know, Siegel was a great candidate, got 47% of the vote. You know, there's a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about Democrats versus Republicans or conservatives versus liberal. That's much more dynamic than that. And you know, again, these trainings, I think, really kind of help people understand how it is that they can reach out without wasting a lot of time trying to figure stuff out.
And so when you go into a Florida or a Georgia or an Alabama, mm-hmm. Or especially in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, something like that. Obviously, you've got to go down there and be able to speak the language. And you've already got people who are able to do that. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not just talking about the dialect of the accent, but I mean, to understand the mm-hmm. Southern mindset as opposed to, say, the Michigan mindset.
Yeah. I mean, 2 years ago, when we did our first training in Mississippi, and we've got one or two since then, you know, probably about 10 people in that audience were actually folks that were evangelical Christians.
Mm-hmm.
They were Democrats.
Yeah.
As one said, we found out that the Republicans lied to us. You know, they may not have the same politics I do, but the most important thing is that they were there to really be involved, and they were really committed to things like Darfur, to doing something about poverty, to doing something about the environment. And, you know, we ought to be helping folks like that who want to get involved. They don't have to agree with everything I agree with or anybody else. So, we're working on that still this year.
Wonderful. Well, Jim, I said, it's such a pleasure to meet you in person. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
That's going to be monumental and magnificent. And I look forward to continued success with Stand With Dr. Dean and hopefully, you know, staying in that. Well, I agree with you. Stay in this fight.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is when we need everybody the most, to make this agenda a reality. So, and thanks for doing what you're doing. I'm looking forward to seeing you in August.
Oh, this is a joy, and it's gonna be a real hoot up there.
Yeah, we'll have some fun.
We're bringing the whole Kincaid crowd, and
good.
We're gonna have little Kincaids running boards here and running boards there, and Guy James will be there. We are gonna have some kind of blast.
Yeah, well, it's fun. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to seeing you there too.
All right, take care.
All right, see ya.
Bye now.
Bye bye.
From Democracy for America, Jim Dean, one of my favorite organizations, and exactly, I'm in agreement on where we stand with healthcare. I'd like universal single payer, but you know what? We got to solve this one way or the other. We didn't get to it, but you know, there's the thing that we've talked about so much, the labor component of all this. We passed the Employee Free Choice Act. Healthcare changes significantly for the rest of the country, and it changes for the better. So it is about nine and a half minutes before the hour, and I've got one more guest scheduled, but I haven't seen him around here, and you know, sometimes it doesn't work out exactly as you'd planned. Guy James will be coming your way. About 2-3 minutes after 3 o'clock with his regular startup. And remember, this continues tomorrow, and it continues Wednesday. So this is going to be quite the busy time. There's I'm told via something that has been handed my way. See, if there wasn't a real memorandum, I couldn't do that. Tonight at, goodness me, there's a progressive media party. You know, nobody parties like progressives. It's always so much more fun than watching a bunch of stodgy old hidebound Republicans. Yeah. Well, you know how it is with stodgy old hidebound Republicans. All they want to do is chase hookers. Drive people into the closet. You know how it works. Hey, look, I'm doing my best. It's 10 minutes till 3 o'clock. I'm not supposed to be on the air for another 3 hours. Give me a break. But It has been exciting, and you know, I have to give credit, big loving props, to John Fox. He has since absented himself from the chat room. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. He's since absented himself from the chat room, but I tell you what, none of this would have happened without John. And John is 14 hours ahead of me. But he was up at, by God, midnight his time, waiting to hear from me and waiting to help make sure that this all worked. And it has worked, and it has worked because of John. So thank you, John. Hope you're getting a nice nap. With all that in mind, I will, well, wait a second. Let me see if I can get my last guess here. Okay, we're waiting for our last interview, and hopefully he'll be here presently. We're expecting to talk to Gabe Gonzalez, National Director of Campaign for Community Values. Community organizer, lobbyist, electoral strategist, 15 years experience. Should be a good conversation. Another person from Chicago. I'll be done in 5 minutes. It's okay. No sweat. No sweat. Okay. So that will probably not happen. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Let's see. What would be fun? What would be good? Yeah, let's play you a little tunage. And wait for Guy James to get started. I never cease to be amazed at how much we do get done here with an engineer in Australia, a streaming manager in Chicago, hosts on the ground right here in D.C. And depending on how things all turn out, if Agnes wants to play too, I might ask her to engineer one of these programs at some point so that... So that maybe we can take some calls either tomorrow or the next day. So we'll call it quits for my show. Guy James is on the way. In point of fact, he'll be here in about 5 minutes or so. You are listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is Activist Radio, The Horn. Thank you for joining in. Thank you for making this the success it has been. And remember, all of this is happening because you determine that you want The Horn to continue to exist. No corporate sponsorship, no Buy Gold Now ads. Just our dedication and your determination to make sure that The Horn continues to fulfill its vision. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Brought to you in part, of course, also by Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org, the hardest working, bravest people I know. So there we have it. That's the broadcast day for me. Thanks, John. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Agnes. Thanks, Sue. Thanks, Lottie. News Ninja Gene, News Ninja Susan. Texas Betsy, the blogger. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And always, 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 Gina. Like I said, Gina, it's all for you.